The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, March the 11th. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum present. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 3074, Senator Pappas. Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here with Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. They had a provision in the agency bill related to data privacy, so we actually had it jacketed as a separate bill so we could bring it to you today. And that's the one you just mentioned. What was the number again?
3074.
3074. Thank you. And really, what they're trying to do is match up data so that they can do the kind of evaluation and the research that they need to do in their accountability system to see if students are being persistent in pursuing higher education or not. And I'll turn it over to Ms. Grimes to elaborate.
Ms. Grimes, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
I will do so. Thank you. Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. This language is about matching data we already collect within the office. We have an enrollment unit, student unit record database, and we have financial aid databases. And upon occasion in the past, the legislature has given us permission to match data from those databases on a kind of a one-time basis. And we've done things like studies of whether state grant recipients persist in college at the same rate as those who don't receive state grants and things like that. It's not collecting new data. And it does specify that the data would only be released to employees or contractors of the agency.
Ms. Grimes, so this information will be shared outside of the university?
Madam Chair, this information will be used within the Office of Higher Education, which is a state agency, and we will any reporting will just be done in aggregate basis. No reporting would be done on data about individual students.
So, Ms. Grimes, there won't be private agencies or there won't be people outside of the governmental agency that will have access to this information?
The only circumstance we can think of that might happen would be if we hired a contractor, and then we would specify in the contract that they would not be able to release the data to anybody except to us.
Any discussions, members? Is there anybody here who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Senator Betzel?
That's fine.
Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 3074 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Pappas, is it your intention to, now that we've taken the vote, to then just add this language to your bill and not... or are you going to move this piece separately?
Madam Chair, I would probably just put it into my bill, my omnibus policy bill, and not move this separately.
All right.
All right. Thanks.
We're going to take the two Sieben bills. Senator Sieben? Senator Sieben, would you like to do the automobile one first?
Yes, Ms. Madam Chair.
Senate File 2594.
92.
Madam Chair, I believe it's 2592.
92.
2592, I apologize.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate File 2592 came to my attention as the result of some constituents whose 17-year-old son, without their knowledge, went out and purchased a car. And it turns out that there are some instances in which a 17-year-old can purchase a car, but it was not clear in statute that a 17-year-old then could purchase insurance. So what this bill simply does is clarify in the statute that that a 17-year-old, if they are able to purchase a car, can purchase insurance. And we have worked with the insurance companies on this, and I don't believe there's any opposition.
Any questions? Senator Sieben, do you have anyone here to testify on this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Would you like your testifiers to come up?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
You don't have anybody. No. You don't have anybody.
My constituents could not be here today, but they did testify in a previous committee.
All right. Any questions for Senator Steven members? Is anybody here who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2592 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Is that where it goes from here, the Senate floor? Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, on the next bill, I just got a copy of the amendment and believe that I need to change it. So perhaps, if it's okay, we could go to the next bill and I could work with council to fix the amendment. What would you prefer? Or I could try to explain why I think the amendment isn't correct.
Senator Stevens, so you need to look at the amendment?
I just got it right now.
Okay. We'll move on to the next bill. Is Senator Latz here? Okay.
Oh. Creek. All right.
This is what we call filler. The next item that we have on the agenda is Senate File 2891, Senator Moore, on Interstate Compact for Juveniles Adoption. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. The Interstate Compact bill is an opportunity here to try to, it's actually for the inclusion of the state of Minnesota in the Interstate Commission for Juveniles, which is looking to replace the Interstate Compact on Juveniles that we've been a part of since 1955. As I mentioned, until now, the Interstate Compact on Juveniles has been the sole mechanism to transfer supervision of non-treatment juveniles across state lines. This compact also assures that juvenile runaways, escapees, and absconders are returned home safely and securely through a consistent legal process. The Interstate Commission for Juveniles is a commission that has been in the making. There are now 41 states have signed on to the Interstate Commission for Juveniles. We were hesitant to participate because we wanted to see how uniformly the rest of the other states are participating. But now, since I believe we're one of maybe 9 states that have not joined, the commission is going to move forward. And if we don't participate, Minnesota will no longer be able to use the compact, which we've been relying on to work with other states, to transfer juvenile supervision and return juvenile runaways, escapees, and absconders. The bill establishes the advisory council, which will raise the level of awareness in the state regarding the juvenile compact, as it did with the adult compact. The Interstate Commission for Juveniles will provide an automatic tracking system of juveniles being transferred and returned under this compact. The Interstate Commission for Juveniles will establish a national commission for the enforcement of the compact rules. And so this bill is really, it looks like it's a lot of new language, which it is, but the intent here is to establish the Minnesota's advisory commission so that, and in essence authorizing us to become a part of this new commission. And I believe Mr. Merz is here to answer any questions, if members have questions about the specifics of the bill.
Mr. Merz, did you have any testimony?
Mr. Chair, no. I'm just here to answer your questions in case there is any.
Okay. Are there any questions of Senator Moore or Mr. Merz? Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 2891? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Merz, have you encountered any opposition of the practitioners on this side? It seems to me that about 2 years back, why I was involved with this very compact, and And we, I got a lot of negative responses from that. What's the total number that are currently active? How many states are?
And Mr. Mers, you'll have to now identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ken Mers. I'm a director with the Community Services Division with the Department of Corrections. Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, there is currently no opposition to this. 2 years ago when we talked with you with regards to this bill, we took the position, as Senator Moi says, that we kind of took a wait-and-see position because we did have some concerns with the compact, and there were a number of states, including us, that were not sure that they were going to get that 35 states in order to continue to move forward with it. So we kind of took a wait-and-see attitude. As Senator Moi stated, they got the 35 states. In fact, there are now 41 states who have passed the legislation. And therefore, we need to pass the legislation so that we can become a part of this and we will have a say in what happens with rules and those type of things.
Sir Foley. Okay. Any other questions? Sir Moi?
Mr. Chair, members, if there is no further discussion, I'd like to move that Senate File 2891 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the floor.
Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Sieben, saw her.
If Senator Sieben is ready to proceed, we can do that. If Senator Latz is here or Senator Saltzman. If not, I'm willing to be a filler.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Well, you got plenty of filler here for us. Which one would you like to take up next?
Mr. Chair, I would like to take up Senate File 2790.
That's the last one on the agenda. Senate File 2790, Juvenile Records, Public Hearings and Access Provisions Modification. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 2790 the context of it is that before I get into the bill, I want to explain a little bit. Things are a little bit uncertain in the way that we move bills in coordination with the other body. And so today, what we will be trying to do with this package of juvenile bills is that we're going to move them out separately, but we will also be creating an omnibus bill for these bills. Senate File 2790 will become the omnibus vehicle for the rest of the other juvenile bills that are on the agenda. And so I'd like to proceed with Senate File 2790 and then lay it on the table, and then we'll take up the other bills, move them out, but their content will also be laid on the table, and at the end, I'll move Senate File 2790 to include all of those bills, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no, Senator Last did show up. Did you wish to proceed with your bill or go to his bill, or how do you wish to do it?
We should take Senator Last's bill because this bill is a little bit longer.
Okay.
And let's get him out of here.
We've got an A3 amendment. Did you want us to act on the A3 amendment on your bill as long as we've got it before us here?
Mr. Chair, that's an author's amendment to put the bill into shape.
Senator Moore moves the A3 author's amendment to Senate File 2790. This is the Committee of Origin. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Then Senate File 2790 is temporarily laid aside. And Senator Latch, you've got two bills. Which one did you wish to proceed with first?
Mr. Chair, the Juvenile Incarceration Bill, Senate File 2755.
Please. Okay. Senate File 2755.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2755 deals with the issue of incarcerating juveniles when they are taken into custody. Right now, they can be and frequently are incarcerated in local adult facilities, we think that's inappropriate. And so this bill requires that when they are taken into custody, they may be detained in a secure juvenile detention facility, and it also sets some parameters as to how to handle it if there aren't any local nearby. and what to do when they turn 18. I do have an A1 amendment. This is our first committee. I'd ask the for this author's amendment to be added to put it in the shape.
Also move, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves the A1 amendment. It's the author's amendment. It's in the packets, members. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I have with me Tim Johnson from the Minnesota Department of Corrections and Cheryl Krieger, the Associate Director of the Juvenile Justice Coalition of Minnesota. Let's see where they are. I ask them to come forward and just make a few remarks support the bill and the amendment itself as well. Okay. I understand Mr. Johnson is going to handle all of the commentary today.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Tim Thompson.
Oh, it's Thompson.
Correct.
Not Johnson.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was asked to do some clarification on the bill to make sure that it met the Federal Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Act. And as written, it appears that that now does that accomplish that goal.
Any discussions or questions for Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, there is one suggestion that was made by the Minnesota Correctional Association, which was to break out the last sentence in paragraph B of subdivision 5 on the A1 amendment into a separate paragraph. I don't know if that works better or worse, whether it be more clear or less clear, but I'll raise that for consideration for the committee and council.
Senator Latz, can you repeat that again? I mean, is this something that you're interested in doing, or?
Well, it was a suggestion. I think it might clarify the language in the bill, but council is better suited to advise on that. If the committee agrees, it would be to take on line 1.22 of the amendment the sentence beginning if the person is 18 and make that into a new paragraph C and then renumber the remaining paragraphs.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, members, I don't know if it would be that great to make it a paragraph C because it does kind of relate back to some of the concepts in the paragraph B. It, maybe if you think it would be more clear, we could have it as a new paragraph within paragraph B but not calling it C.
That's the way to do it.
Separate it out but not reletter it.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to counsel's judgment on the best formatting for that.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Backus has it correct. It is more related to paragraph B than a standalone. So I'd make it a standalone paragraph within paragraph B.
Okay. Senator Higgins moves that on line 1.22, starting with the word if, to the end of the period of line 1.25, made that a separate paragraph within parent B. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I'm trying to understand what is being done in the sentence that starts on 1.19, where the person must be confined in the quarter separate from any adult confined in the facility that allow for complete sight and sound separation for all activities during the period of detention. I'm sure that's a concept within the corrections area. What does complete sight and sound separation for all activities mean?
Senator Latz or Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, the purpose of that is, through the federal guidelines, is to keep sight and sound separation of juveniles from adults. And this language would help accomplish that.
Well,
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, you're defining a term with the same term. Does that mean that the juveniles and the adults have to be in different places so they can't see and hear each other? I don't understand what the term sight and sound separation means, and defining it with the same term doesn't explain it to me.
Mr. Thompson, in practice, what does this translate into?
Madam Chair, what it means is that the facility would have to take all measures to make sure that an adult does not have visual of a juvenile at any time while in the facility, or that they cannot communicate verbally while in the facility.
So, Mr. Thompson, that means separate eating hours, basically separate quarters, no physical interaction while the two populations are in the same facility?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you had any feedback from the counties that there's any concern that they won't be able to do this, or do they all feel that this is something they can accomplish?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, that is the current practice, is that they are able to keep them sight and sound separate. They are currently doing this as much as they possibly can based on their facility.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
So, Madam Chair, then my second question is, in terms of having an alternative available after 24 hours, is there that type of alternative available in all areas? I mean, is it a situation where there's going to be some place after 24 hours for them to go if that's needed?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, typically that what happens is the juvenile has the hearing within that time. If not, then that person would be transported to a facility more suited for them.
Any other discussions? Any other questions for Senator Latz? Anybody here who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate file 2755, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, Senate file 560 is the expungement reform bill.
Senate File 560. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair and members, you have heard legislation over the years attempting to reform the state expungement statutes. There had been significant disagreement between all of the stakeholders as to how best to accomplish that. What you have before you today is a trimmed-down version of expungement reform, the terms of which have achieved consensus among the stakeholders. County Attorney's Office, County Attorney's Association, the Council on Crime and Justice, and the other parties that have been interested in this subject are coming together today to support this particular package. Phil Carruthers is here, I believe, right behind me. Phil, if you'd come on up, Prosecution Division of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and he'll be speaking on behalf of the County Attorneys Association. And Mark Hazy from the Council on Crime and Justice is going to try to be here, but he has a conflicting hearing over in the House, so I'm not sure if he'll make it. But Mr. Carruthers could expand.
Senator Latz, is Mr. Carruthers going to walk us through the bill?
I can do that if you. Oh, here's Mr. Hazy. So either one of them could walk us through the bill, or I could do that, Madam Chair, whatever you prefer.
Senator Latz, why don't you walk us through the bill? And then there's an A7 and A8 amendment. Are you aware of those two amendments?
The A7 amendment, Madam Chair, is a delete everything amendment, so it might be best to
yes.
Adopt that right away.
Why don't you walk us through the bill so we know what the bill is about, and then we'll go to the two amendments. And then we'll start the discussion.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
If the A7 amendments are delete all, wouldn't it be better to do that one? And
I agree. Senator Betzel, this is a first engrossment.
Oh. So it is, yes.
Right?
First.
This came to us from... That's right. We had heard the bill here. We sent it to finance, and then it was brought back from finance to judiciary because the different parties had been working on the language, and the delete everything A7 amendment is the new language that they want to. Make it to put the bill into shape.
Okay.
So instead of walking through the bill, I'd like Senator Latz perhaps then to walk us through the A7 amendment, which is why you've brought the bill back to us.
Thank you. do we need to, should I just walk through it before we take action to substitute the language?
Right.
I think what I'll do, Madam Chair, is give you the, if I might, the highlights of the terms, or do you want me to walk through the language of the bill in order?
Well, Senator Latz, the A7 is the delete everything amendment to the bill.
It's pretty straightforward. I'll just go straight through
A7. So just walk us through the A7 because that's the full content of the bill.
Madam Chair and members, Section 1 of the A7 amendment adds to the definition of criminal proceedings that are considered to be resolved not resulting in a conviction. Under the current statutory framework for expungement, expungements are available. Statutory expungement is available, meaning it would affect not only judicial records, but records maintained outside the judicial branch in the executive branch agencies, the BCA, local law enforcement agencies, and so on, prosecution offices, city attorney's offices, for example. If the matter was resolved not resulting in a conviction. That covers a very narrow band of resolutions right now, and what Section 1 does is it adds to the category of cases or resolutions that will be considered for statutory expungement to include successful completions of a diversion program or of a stay of adjudication that was agreed to by the prosecutor. So on a diversion program, there typically are there's not even any admissions, but sometimes there are, depending on the process. But the case is never actually litigated in any way in the court. The case is diverted into an alternative process. And if the person successfully completes that diversion process, then the charges are dismissed. But that's technically not included in the current statutory definitions. So this would allow for expungement upon the appropriate findings being made for a successful completion of diversion. In a stay of adjudication, typically a person pleads guilty to whatever the offense is, but the court holds the plea. The court does not enter the conviction. So that definitely is outside the current definition of a resolution in favor of the offender or the not resulting in conviction. This would bring stays of adjudication into the fold for expungement, so long as the prosecutor agreed to the stay of adjudication ahead of time. There are some circumstances. Sometimes judges will stay adjudication of a case even if the prosecutor is opposing it. And there's some uncertain appellate law as to authority to do that, uncertain in some judges' minds, I suppose. But sometimes it happens, and the idea here is where all the parties agree that the stay of adjudication is appropriate, then expungement can take place after successful completion of the stay. And then also 1 year has passed after the stay is completed or the diversion is completed as well without any new crimes being charged. So essentially you have 2 years of good behavior. From the time the matter is resolved in court, either with a diversion or a stay of adjudication. So they successfully complete the probation, if you will, the stay or the diversion with no new charges, and then 1 year after that with no new charges. And then they can qualify for expungement. The Section 2 provides for an expedited process for that expungement to take place. Rather than having to go through the more extensive process right now with extensive notifications and time delays at various stages in the process, this provides for the expungement to happen without filing a petition unless for some reason the court determines that the public interest requires such a petition and a more extended public evaluation of the matter.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Lance, could you give us some examples of when this would be appropriate to use this provision?
Senator
Lance. Expedited process?
Senator Lance.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, it would be appropriate in just about any case that there wasn't any real controversy over the issues. If the person has complied with all of the conditions, adjudication was stayed or a diversion was successfully completed, there may not be other extenuating circumstances relating to that individual. You don't have a victim that is expected to be raising any issues or objections. A lot of these expungements happen without any controversy, but they are still required to notify a dozen different parties and wait several months before you can get into court, so there's time for objections to be raised, and then have a hearing on it, and then wait another several months before the court can actually implement the expungement. So it's a process that is burdensome on the courts as well as on all the parties involved in expungement under the current system. So now if the prosecutor is still going to have notice of this, and if they thought there was some reason that there ought to be a more extended hearing, they can request that, and the judge could agree and go through the more extended process as well. But in most expungements, they're fairly routine in that regard, and there's no need to have the more extensive process.
Senator Olson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, I have kind of a broad question for you. Last year and the year before, we looked at we passed legislation that had to deal with the harvesting of information and wanted to make sure that information, when it's out there, would be accurate. And broadly, I know that both criminal information, credit information, medical information, a lot of information about people is more and more being harvested independent of government agencies or government within the government. And so once that information is out there, first, I guess I'm just wondering if you know how this would interact with the requirement that information be updated. If once information has been expunged, but it was actually accurate information to begin with, if there's going to be a requirement that criminal information be removed from some information out there in the sky, and then secondly, you know, to the extent that the legislation that we passed doesn't impact necessarily all areas of how this information is being stored and sold and resold, doesn't the expungement have less of an impact than it might have before we had that kind of activity going on?
Senator Olson, I'd like Mark Hazy to respond to that.
Mr. Hazy, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hazy. I am the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy with the Council on Crime and Justice. Madam Chair and Senator Olson, when we advise people about whether an expungement is a good remedy for them or not, we advise them that it's not always a perfect remedy. And one reason for that is the issue you bring up. There's, thousands of private data collectors out there that purchase government data and sell it to employers and landlords. And an expungement order does not apply to them. It just applies to government records. But it is a remedy in that criminal background checks are regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and that requires that credit reporting agencies update their records, and that updating includes when they go back to the government record, if the record's not there, it shouldn't show up again. They don't save, they're not supposed to save the old data. Now, not all, companies follow the law, so. It may be that there could be some point out there where the information comes up, and we have to advise our clients about that. But if a company is using, a reputable background checking company, an employer is using a reputable background checking company, and it's been expunged, eventually it should come off, and we know that, clients have found that to be a helpful remedy. Does that answer your question, Senator Olson?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, are you saying that under existing law, once something's been expunged, that we do require that someone outside of the government, if they had that information originally and it was accurate at the time that it was harvested, that they are required to eliminate that information? Or is that just for certain? I'm just wondering if you could clarify whether it should come off or it's required to come off.
Madam Chair, Senator
Olson,
under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, for purposes of employment and housing, when it's being sold commercially, then yes, it is required to be, they're required to update their records again, and that should come off of there.
Any further discussions on the A7 amendment?
Madam Chair?
Senator Latz.
If I might just add 2 points. This does apply to executive agency records as well. So to Senator Olson's point, it's not just records that are maintained in the court administrator's office, but when they're updating other records maintained in other areas, they should get the updated information as well after an expungement. And then the second point I wanted to make is the expedited process that's described in Section 2 would allow for the expungement without even the necessity of a petition, where it's agreed ahead of time by the prosecutor that the matter can be handled without a formal petition at all. Then it can be done without the subject of the records even having to bring a petition into court. And the prosecutor does have to make reasonable efforts to notify the victim or alleged victim in a case that that's what's anticipated.
Senator Latz, the A8 amendment is an amendment to the A7 amendment. So could you speak to that? And then we'll have both the A8 and A7 in front of us for the discussion.
Sure.
And then at the end, we'll just, once we've had the discussion, then we can maybe adopt both of them.
Madam Chair, the A8 amendment would address the question of the access by law enforcement, prosecution, and corrections authorities to expunged records. Under current statute, if they would like to have that access, they must seek and obtain an ex parte court order, or a court order, which typically is done ex parte, to be able to access the sealed records. The amendment would allow them to do that without getting that court order first. It is limited to the purposes of criminal investigation, prosecution, or sentencing, so they are purposes for which they would be entitled typically anyway to have access to those expunged records. For example, if something were expunged there were to be an allegation of a new offense of a similar nature within a time frame for enhancing that, the law enforcement could take a look at those expunged records to see, is this an enhanceable offense or isn't it? And prosecution will be able to take that into account, possibly also to consider for Spriegel purposes. And what this would do then is it would, frankly, reduce a lot of procedure. The courts have to deal with these orders, which are pretty routine requests for access to these documents. The prosecutors have to put together the requests and go over to the courts to get the orders. It just adds delay in time and paperwork, which translates to money and administrative burden. So this would expedite that process. And it was part of the compromise agreement that all the stakeholders involved in coming together on this bill. This is one of the trade-offs that it was felt was worth it to advance the general purpose of the bill.
Senator Betzel.
But, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, under the current law, they'd have to get a court order, and then with that court order, then that would unseal the records. Without the court order, doesn't that mean that just law enforcement or prosecutors or corrections authorities, there might be more requests now because they don't have to go through the process of getting a court order. Wouldn't that be more of a burden to the court if more people are showing up saying, well, I want you to unseal the record so I can see what's in there? It seems to me that could add to the clerk's business in having to deal with more requests since you don't have to worry about that court order in the first place.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, first of all, a lot of the requests would go to the BCA and not necessarily to the courts to get copies of the underlying expunged records. Typically, they are looking for this information anyway. If they feel it might be relevant to an investigation, they're going to go get the court order. Here it just saves them that step. But perhaps Mr. Carruthers could address that particular more directly, since his agency is one that seeks this information.
Mr. Carruthers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I'm Philip C. Carruthers. I'm the director of the Prosecution Division for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think Senator Latz said it very well. Currently, if we're working on a case and we know that there's a sealed conviction or a sealed record, then we have to make an application to the court to unseal it. And this way, it's much less paperwork, especially for our courts, because we can go and get it directly from the BCA. And it may be we find out when we look at the BCA record, oh, this isn't anything that we're going to be concerned about. You know, maybe we're investigating somebody for a crime of violence, and then it turns out that the sealed conviction was for a bad check. And so, you know, we don't even have to do any more work. We don't have to track it down, and that's the last we're going to think about it. But, you know, the current system, we don't know what's there, so we've got to go to all the work of getting, and a court has to review and sign an order. And, you know, what we're trying to do, both in terms of making it easier for people to get expungements in certain circumstances, is reduce the amount of paperwork and the court procedure, and we're trying to do that on the back end as well in terms of investigation and prosecution of cases.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, and then Mr. Carruthers, if you know, I mean, I take it the BCA does keep track of the requests, and so they know it's being sealed and unsealed, so that if there is, say, somebody going on fishing expedition, so to speak, or, you know, abusing the process by asking for information without much of a basis to it, there'd be a way to find out if somebody's asking for a lot of information that's supposed to be expunged, and we'd be able to track that down, or do you know if any records are kept?
Mr. Carruthers.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, the BCA is very careful about doing keeping an audit. There's an audit trail of any request for BCA data. So when a prosecutor or a law enforcement officer makes a request for a criminal record, I know in our office we're required by the BCA to keep a log of all requests. And the name of the prosecutor is kept right on that log, and then that's our document. And then the BCA, on the other hand, they have an audit. So if there is abuse, and we have seen situations where, you know, there have been accusations of improperly getting BCA criminal history, then, you know, that audit is there, and the appropriate agency can investigate it. And there have been instances in which people have been disciplined, even charged with criminal offenses for improperly accessing BCA information.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To me, I guess the compromise here seems like what we're saying is that on the one hand, we're going to make it easier for people to get a fresh start in some circumstances where it seems appropriate so that they're not impacted in terms of housing and jobs and that kind of thing. But the trade-off or the balance on the other side is we're going to make it easier for law enforcement to access information. And I think, you know, in terms of whether that makes sense, it's important to think about what our underlying policy rationale is for expungement. And if the policy rationale is to give people a fresh start but not at the expense of impeding law enforcement activities, then I think it makes sense. And I guess I, if that's the thinking, I'm okay with that policy because I don't think we want to impede law enforcement's ability to do its job. What we're really driving at least from my perspective, is that someone who's had good behavior and for the right kinds of offenses isn't prohibited from getting a job or from getting housing, not to pretend from law enforcement standpoint that this never happened, as if we evaporate the information. So I guess that's kind of how I'm looking at it.
Mr. Hussey or Mr. Carruthers, do either of you have testimonies that you want to submit on the AA87 amendment? Mr. Carruthers.
Madam Chair and members, I would just like to say that the Minnesota County Attorneys Association has received the message from the chair and a number of the members of the committee that you really wanted us to work with the Council on Crime and Justice and the defense lawyers to see, is there some medium ground on the issue of expungement, and we heard that and took it very seriously. And this is part of the effort to, you know, to try to reach that that medium ground, and to really try to get a situation where people who deserve expungement can get it and get it as easily and quickly as possible.
Ms. Neumeister, I'll get to you. Mr. Hasse?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that the County Attorney's Association and the Criminal Defense Bar really have stepped up to work on this. It's really, in some ways, a fairly small step forward. We're still just talking about non-conviction records. But my hope is that it can be a step forward on a longer road to finding good ways for, as Senator Olson was mentioning, safely allow people to move on from their mistakes of the past when it's appropriate and be able to find housing and employment and become fully contributing, you know, members of our communities and support themselves and their families. So just want to thank everyone involved in the committee for their work.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister, and I oppose the 8-8 amendment. One of the things, I am not one of the stakeholders, but I am someone who many years have been a stakeholder, sometimes indirectly and directly, by working on these kinds of policies and with a great number of citizens and trying to do with things. Secondly, over the last 25 years of the 30 years I've been here, expungement has been a major thing that I've worked on off and on. The bill that is being amended this year was the product of Senator Betzelt and Representative Crowther 14 years ago. One of the things was, and what this amendment deletes, is where an independent person, a judge, is going to make a determination of whether or not law enforcement should be able, county prosecutors and correction supervision, just to be able to go in and say, I want to take a look at someone's file. And one of the things, it's not just the BCA records. We're talking about, at least since 1996, and even before then, thousands and thousands of records of non-conviction records. It could also apply to those that, until the Schultz decision, just a couple of years of the Supreme Court, which under the inherent authority of the court, we're also talking about as the bill is retooled, reformed, whatever, to expand, it's going to also include those other kinds of records. Now, one of the things I contend there are like at least 30 to 50,000 expunged records on individuals. That's just an educated guess, at least from talking to people and things I've read about here in Minnesota. One of the things I do have concerns is that there are a lot of things that are expunged that deal with privacy and reputations of individuals. I am not aware of the accountability standards of local law enforcement. At least I know that there is a court order that's needed, and at least there is some accountability that a judge is signing off saying, whatever, you know, whatever the process might be, if that judge determines to ask some independent questions or whatever. I think this, we're developing a secret process, in my judgment, on this. And this, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just found out about this two days ago. And as someone who has tries to do very thorough work on these kinds of policy changes, I've just been able just to get into it. I haven't had the opportunity to start looking at what other states are doing. I am aware, based on research that was done, as you may or may not know, I sit on the community just the CRIMNET committee. I forget the formal name, the Criminal Justice Committee. And we have looked at expungement issues in the past. Me and Ray Schmitz are the longest serving people for the last 16 years on that. At least 4 or 5 years ago, when we were looking at that issue system-wide again, some states are different, but at least a great many of states have some independent review aspect when folks started to go wanting to look at 20-year-old records, 10-year-old records, 5-year-old records. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would urge you not to accept this amendment. Maybe there were some stakeholders at the table when they came with this deal, from my perspective, but there are a lot of folks who are probably have a strong interest in their reputations and their privacy and just want to know, I think, just a few more questions. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Latz, on the A8 amendment, I understand the need to, and I think we've talked about this before, to open up the expunged records, perhaps to law enforcement for criminal investigation purposes. But here we're saying that we're allowing it to prosecution for prosecution or sentencing purposes, and I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. I thought that the whole idea about getting an expungement was that then you don't have to relive it, and it seems to me it's a false hope to say, well, we're going to let you get an expungement, but when we feel like it, we can go back and dig it up, and we can use it to prosecute you and to sentence you. And so what's the value in that?
Madam Chair and members, for me anyway, and I think for the folks that have worked on this, the main thrust of this bill is, as Senator Olson mentioned, to make it easier for people who have histories of one sort or another to get jobs or to get housing. They find that even a charge that resulted in a diversion and a dismissal, or even a plea that was held and no conviction was entered, because it's a matter of public record and a background check, it shows up in all the court records with all of the history and makes it tougher for people to get jobs or housing as a result. So that, to me, was the main thrust of the bill, and the A8 amendment would not interfere with that. It seems to me it's a different question when you are once again involved in the criminal justice system. Should the criminal justice system have access to that history in the criminal justice system? And I, for one, don't see that as problematic.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've always believed that expungement could be used as an incentive, and in this case, it is offering an incentive to folks that are going through adjudication, a stay of adjudication or diversion, that if they follow the court's expectations and then they don't reoffend for a year, then they qualify for an expungement and that second chance that they've been trying to accomplish. And I think almost anyone in those circumstances would be willing to give law enforcement access as necessary in exchange for the ability to get that second chance. And I think that is what we're trying to weigh here, and I think that's what we're trying to accomplish, and I think it's a laudable goal. And I can't imagine anybody in those circumstances that would give up the opportunity for a second chance to say that law enforcement could only get it with a court order. I think the balance here is right, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, one other point.
Senator Latz.
Which is that this is a kind of access to records that law enforcement and the prosecution and judges for sentencing are going to get anyway, but now they have to go get a separate ex parte order to get access to it. If they're considering what charges to bring or how to handle a case, or if they're doing a criminal investigation and they do a typical background check and they learn that there were expunged records, because that information anyway, they'll be able to know that there were records that were sealed. It's their duty to do due diligence and obtain that information that was expunged so they can complete the investigation. This would remove a significant procedural impediment in that process. But they're going to be getting access to these records anyway when it's appropriate.
Senator Olson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one more little bit of a follow-up on the point about talking about the policy of what expungement's for. And reiterating, if a person has turned their life around, we want to encourage that, and we want to give them an opportunity to get housing and get a job and really reward that kind of good behavior. But if a person is back in trouble again, do we really want them to be able, is there a public policy purpose served by saying that it should be more difficult to use that earlier bad behavior to enhance a sentence or to make a later criminal prosecution more difficult? I mean, I just don't see what public policy would be served by making law enforcement go to get a court order when it's for that type of purpose.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, it's not at all uncommon that when you you have a case processed through the juvenile court and the judge has an expungement or a stay of adjudication, and with the idea, and they many times tell the culprit, if you will, that there you've got a situation where what the judge tells that child is not what comes out in the end, and that's taken out of the mix. And so, looking at that, what's the sense of having a stay of adjudication or expungement if, in fact, you can have it in a public record and so forth? So it isn't where you're helping the individual, because the people that have access to his record are going to see that. And I don't know how you can get around dealing with the individual and where it goes in the court system, and then the court throws the case out, if you will. How do you deal with that?
Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, I'm not entirely clear on the question, Senator Foley, but I will note that there may be some special way of handling juvenile records that I'm not in a position to deal with. But I do note that the idea here is to remove from the public record information about these cases that never resulted in a conviction in the first place, that in the judgment of the prosecution and the alleged offender, as they resolved the case, that did not get a conviction, but can still harm the offender when they're applying for jobs or for housing because they are a matter of public record. You can go on Mensis right now and you can, you know, you look up someone's name and date of birth and it'll tell you charges that may have been charged and dismissed. They might have been dismissed outright, but you'll know that they were charged. They might
How do you, Madam Chair?
Senator Foley.
Senator Letts, how do you solve that? I mean, that's what I'm anxious to see removed from the mix, is to some way to develop cover, if you will, to allow that stay there.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Latz.
Senator Foley, at least for the cases where they have not resulted in a conviction, you solve that by voting for this bill, because then it will seal those records from public view. The only access will be by law enforcement and corrections and the prosecutors if they're investigating or considering sentencing. But as far as the public, if you a job applicant and a potential employer wants to do a criminal background check, it would not show up. There'd be no record of it. In the case of a housing application, if you want to rent an apartment, it would not show up. So that would be sealed, at least for this narrow band of cases where no conviction has resulted. The categories that we're not addressing in this bill are those cases where there was a conviction. And we might be able to agree that there are certain categories of convictions that we also want to see expunged. But the stakeholders have not been able to come to a consensus on how to handle those and how broad to make that reach. So we're doing what we can achieve, what we think is achievable today, which is at least for these categories of cases that do not result in conviction, to be able to expunge those in a fairly straightforward manner.
Senator Altman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think with one of the biggest obstacles that we've faced in passing any expungement reform has been the fiscal note for these hearings. And if you have ex parte hearings, every time law enforcement has a concern, we're going to have an expense for the courts that we can't justify. And that's been a big obstacle for making meaningful reform. So if Senator Latz is okay with it, I'd like to move the A8 amendment.
Senator Orman has moved the A8 amendment. Senator Latz, I don't have any concerns about removing the ex parte, the requirement for the ex parte. As I said before, I don't think that I'm concerned about law enforcement having access to the record. And as I think about it, your argument makes sense that if these people are back in the criminal justice system in some way, that having corrections having access to the information is one way. But I guess, Mr. Carruthers, I am somewhat concerned about prosecution having access to the information. At least for law enforcement, you can say that there is a legitimate public safety concern that law enforcement need it for investigative purposes. At least for corrections, you can say that, you know, this person has, as Senator Ladd said, they messed up and they're back in the system. And so we could, in essence, their past record is fair game. But the prosecution has a fair amount of latitude. And these are arrest records that we're talking about. And so in being able to have access to these arrest records, to what extent is are the arrest records now become part of the portfolio of the toolkit of prosecution to negotiate for a potential plea where there might not be a willingness for one? So, Mr. Carruthers, I wonder if you could reassure me or speak to that issue.
Madam Chair, you know, there are a number of reasons why prosecutors, in addition to the court or probation or corrections, would want to get access. One would be for potential sentencing issues. If we're trying to negotiate a case, for example, we need to know, and the defense attorney needs to know, you know, what prior convictions are there out there, because those will affect, under sentencing guidelines, the number of points that someone has and will affect their potential sentence. And, you know, both the prosecution and the defense, we need to have an accurate sense of what prior convictions are out there. And, you know, we're not even to the point yet where the case has been resolved, and so that now the court will want to get access to that same information for sentencing purposes. We're trying to negotiate the case, and, you know, both sides are trying to treat the defendant fairly and accurately. And, you know, so we need to know, and frankly, you know, sometimes defendants don't truly remember the extent of their record, or they may not remember an older conviction. And so, you know, you're trying to have as accurate information as possible so that you can resolve or not resolve the case. You know, it may turn out that somebody has a number of expunged convictions and maybe you can't resolve the case, but that's very important information to know. And, you know, once we obtain this, this is something that we share with the defendant's attorney. You know, this is, it's because we want them to know this. In fact, I believe they need to know this. So it would be disclosable. The other situation would be, as Senator Latz mentioned, would be a Spriegel-type situation. Spriegel is other crimes evidence. So, like, let's say you had a situation where somebody had a prior assault or a prior criminal sexual conduct charge that then was ultimately expunged. The prosecution and the investigator will want to know, well, what were the facts of that prior event, and are those similar in their facts so that that could be admissible as other crimes evidence, Spriegel-type evidence. And, you know, we're going to get this information because what we would do currently is we get an ex parte order from the court. We're going to get it. All this says is instead of having to go through the rigmarole and the additional court procedure, we'd get it administratively from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. But, you know, we're not going to be the current ex parte order situation is not going to stop us from getting that because that's going to be very important. If it's a serious case, we're going to want to know about what that person's prior conduct is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
For the non-conviction type cases that are the specific focus of this bill, the prior conduct can still be relevant from the prosecution standpoint in determining how to approach plea bargaining or potential resolution of the case and what kind of a sentence perhaps to recommend or to request from a judge in new charges or new cases. And also, it might ultimately be helpful to the offender or the alleged offender if the parties can determine some common elements between past behavior and a new charge. Might not be evident from one case report, but you see it in two case reports, a common thread of alcohol or a common thread of anger issues or something like that, and they may decide to request or recommend to the court a little more in terms of chemical dependency evaluation or anger management programming or something else that might be more appropriate in that particular case.
Any further discussions on the AA amendment? I think that it is appropriate to put the AA amendment to the A7 amendment, and then we will talk about adopting the A7 amendment. Any further discussions on Senator Ortman's motion to move the AA amendment to amend the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Any further discussions on the A7 amendment? Is there anybody here who would like to testify either for or against the A7 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Ortman moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevail.
This is quite the...
To go to the floor?
I think so. I don't know.
Madam Chair, I would move the bill.
Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 586S amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions?
Madam Chair,
Senator
Latz. 560.
Senator File 560. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is my take.
Senator Saltzman. Senator Saltzman, Senate File 2832.
You're right, Madam Chair. And I hope you have the first engrossment.
We are looking at the first engrossment. Is there an amendment, Senator Saltzman?
Very good.
Senator Saltzman, Senate File 2832.
Here you go. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. As you know, last session I was before you on the attorney's fees bill, and that bill was sent to the floor. It was voted down on its first second reading, which is very difficult for an author. But I appreciate the work that many people did to discuss with my colleagues that this bill should be given a second chance. It was passed with another amendment that would call for a working group to be put together to look at the issue of home warranties, so that instead of just looking at the end result of when we have problems with warranties, what should we be doing up front so that we can avoid some of the litigation that often occurs. That bill did pass both the House and Senate and was vetoed by the governor, but in his veto letter, he did express interest in having a homeowner warranty task force review this issue and ask Commissioner Swigum to do that. As a result of that, over the interim, Charlie Durenberger, who is here today from the Department of Labor and Industry, did put together this group. And I must say that it did not have a fiscal note, and so this was something that the department did. And I also want to commend the many people who were involved in this working group, in that, as you know, when we solve problems down here, it's really important that all the different parties involved come to the table. And that includes the homeowners, it includes the builders, but it also includes the insurance agents and some of the other parties that are impacted with home warranties. That group met a number of times, I believe beginning in like August, September, and it has continued and is continuing to meet, but did put forth the interim report on homeowner warranty task force issues of February 4th. And I would like Mr. Durenberger to just review that with you, and then Mr. O'Meara, who is here, who I understand has to leave, just to speak briefly about it. It is a good starting point for the discussion, and we still need to continue to talk about the attorney fee concerns. But this is a good start to look at how can we bring homeowners and builders together. And when people first talked to me in 2007 about carrying this bill, one of the things that the attorney said to me was that if we could have attorney's fees, that's going to force builders and homeowners to come to the table and talk.
and then you won't need us because they'll come to the table, they'll solve the problem because this attorney fee will hang over their head. Well, we need to work on that, but in the meantime, this bill begins to look at when there are problems, is there a process in place so that homeowners have some protection and builders also have some sort of process to follow. And so this is bringing the homeowners and builders together. And I do know that we added some language in Senator Scheid's committee, but I would like Mr. Dernberger to first address the group. And again, thank him for the work that he did because this was a very an interesting group to pull together. And I know that they had many spirited discussions, but it was good to see that from that first meeting to the meetings at the end, I felt that there was some understanding of some of the different issues involved in this. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Saltzman, are you walking us through the bill first, or is Mr. Dernberger walking us through the bill?
I'd like to, if he could talk about the interim report, Madam Chair, because the bill is based on some of the recommendations within the report. Would that be helpful to you, or would you like to hear the bill first?
You know, it's coming to us from another committee. I guess I don't know that we need to take up a whole lot of Mr. Dernberger's time. We should just go through. We understand that it's the result of a report with some recommendations. We'd like you or Mr. Dernberger maybe to walk us quickly through the bill, and then we'll just take testimony on the bill.
How about if I start going through the bill, and if Mr. Dernberger needs to jump in on anything, that would be great because it was taken off the report, but I will walk through it.
Thank you.
The first section is written contracts are required. Now this section requires a builder to give a potential client a copy of the performance standards with the contract. It really has to do with setting expectations for homeowners and also builders. Under Section 2, it clarifies the definition of a vendor, the language.
Senator Saltzman, I think, do you have the first engrossment?
Yes, I do.
Oh.
It's not tracking.
So what was Section 1? It's not Section 2.
So what was Section 1 is now Section 2, right?
Are you saying?
Enter Section 3.
Yes. Okay. What just talks about? Okay. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I may have a different section-by-section highlight because of the engrossment. So maybe Section 2 is Section 1, which I just described to do. So the written contracts required. All right? Does that make sense?
Right. Yes.
Yep. Okay. If you then go into Section 3, it defines vendor. It clarifies this brings an entity who has foreclosed on a home and let it sit without finishing the home into the warranty law. Section 4 then describes inspection. And Section 5 begins to talk about the right to inspect. And again, it lays out for purposes of like if there is damage that is caused from the result of inspection, that it be promptly patched or repaired, that some of the concerns that some of the homeowners have brought forward is that if there is a response from a vendor of a notice and right to inspect, that they would be responsible then for repairing any damage that might occur as a result of that inspection. Going on then to, I believe, Section 6 is the right to repair agreement, and it requires a builder or else remodeler to provide a written offer to repair within 15 days of the inspection. It must include the scope of the proposed work and the time frame in which the work will start and end. It also allows the homeowner the opportunity to obtain an estimate on the scope of work from another contractor. If the parties do not agree in the scope of work, they must go to a pre-litigation panel, and that is non-binding. And then upon completion of the repairs described, the vendor or homeowner must provide the vendee with a written notice that the scope of the work has been, completed. In Subdivision 6, the failure to inspect a repair allows a homeowner to commence an action for breach of warranty if the builder or remodeler fails to perform the inspection. Subdivision 7 deals with it is a process required before the commencement of action. And again, this has to go to the fact of, can we allow the builders to work with the homeowners on these issues before they seek a lawsuit. In Section 8, the effect of certain action clarifies that certain parties are not vendors.
Madam Chair, Senator Salzman, your summary is not tracking the first engrossment.
Okay.
Section 8 deals with process required by for commencement of action. Section 9 is effect of certain actions.
Okay. I think I'm one off. Excuse me, Senator. Okay, Betzel. So in Section 8, it is the process required before commencement of action. You are correct. Section 9 is the effect of certain action. It clarifies which parties are not vendors if they indemnify a contractor. Section 10 is, this is what we added in Senator Scheid's committee, is the home warranty dispute resolution process. And it refers to a panel of neutrals. It allows the Department of Labor and Industry to establish a panel of qualified neutral evaluators to determine alleged damage dispute. It imposes a $250 fee for construction defect to apply as a neutral evaluator. In Subdivision 2, it dispute resolution fees are described. The neutral evaluator, neutral evaluation is described in Subdivision 3. And after being chosen, the qualified neutral will then set a date for the conference with the parties within 30 days after the selection. It provides that all parties must give information and necessary documentation to the qualified neutral to help understand the dispute. The information must be handled over within 7 days of the conference. There must be a written determination within 10 days of the conference. And the parties shall share expenses of qualified neutral's billable time. The qualified neutral's time may not exceed 6 hours unless agreed to by both parties. And then Subdivision 4 is an alternative process. It allows the parties to pursue a different form of alternative dispute resolution if agreed to by both parties. They must then, report back that they have chosen a different process. In Subdivision 5, the effect of future proceedings, the written determination by the qualified neutral is then confidential, and determinations may not be used as evidence of subsequent in other cases, and the neutral cannot be called on to testify in other dispute proceedings. And in Section 11, is a report to the legislature on the number of cases that are established under this statute and identify the number of cases that are use this process. And then we have the effective dates. So, Madam Chair, that is essentially, it lays out a process that can address some of these issues up front. And again, there is still the issue of the attorney's fees, but the attempt here was to look at, and this was in the legislation that we passed last year, we asked, for this to be done. As a result of that report, this is the work that they did. And Mr. Dernberger, do you have anything else to add on in terms of things that I may have missed in this?
Mr. Dernberger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I really don't have anything else to add other than to just explain that this was a group that we put together and did our best to find a group of homeowners, insurance companies, builders, and other people that we knew had an interest in this issue and made it clear that the goal of what we were trying to do was to figure out a way for homeowners and builders to resolve these types of disputes without everybody having to lawyer up and incur lots of attorney's fees. And as Senator Salzman had indicated, some of these discussions did get pretty animated, and there's quite a divide in many of these cases between the homeowner and the builder, because this is a very emotional issue for homeowners. I mean, this is not only their biggest financial investment, but it's also they've got a huge emotional investment in their home as well. So those are issues that we really had to deal with and overcome. And I think that all the parties, if nothing else we accomplished, learned a lot from each other. And there was a lot of misunderstandings that people had. And it was an education process for everybody. But I think that the bill, as it's written now, addresses all the issues that we had agreement on, as Senator Saltzman also indicated, the attorney's fees issue is huge. And that was a big one for the homeowners. They felt very strongly that that was a key to a resolution. And at one point, we did have a proposal that came forward that was what I perceived to be a compromise on the issue. We didn't achieve any sort of a consensus on that that compromise, but we do intend to continue to work on that issue. But we do think that this is a process that's proposed here that will essentially compel the homeowner and the builder to get together before they commence a lawsuit or a lawsuit is commenced to get a neutral evaluation, have somebody that is knowledgeable about residential construction, give both parties as quickly as possible and as inexpensively as possible a good idea of where each party stands, so that if they're one side or the other is being unreasonable, they've got that knowledge going in, and that may influence the decision on whether or not to file a lawsuit and start the clock and the fee meter running on the attorneys.
Mr. Dernberger, thank you for your leadership, and thank you for taking on this project. I think it's made a big difference to the end product that's here before the committee. Ms. O'Mara?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Seamus O'Mara. I'm an attorney in private practice in Minneapolis. I represent homeowners, builders, public entities in the construction process. And I also serve as an arbitrator for the American Arbitration Association, and I do a lot of residential construction defect neutral evaluations and arbitration proceedings as part of the AAA process. I think Mr. Dernberger and Senator Saltzman, Madam Chair, are accurate. Our task force met. It was a nice cross-section, and I appreciate the Department of Labor and Industries leadership in that realm, as well as Senator Saltzman's. I think it's important to reflect that the early neutral evaluation process is a good one, and it allows a conversation between the builder and the homeowner to continue without the need to bring lawyers in and charge fees, without the need to imbue that process with a lot of experts. It takes the discussion that existed when that contract was first negotiated at that kitchen table and attempts to continue that process with the good guidance of a qualified early neutral evaluator. And I'm proud to be a part of the task force to make that recommendation to you. I think that's about all I'd like to say on that point. In terms of the process, I think Senator Saltzman has accurately reflected what the bill what the amendment to Senate File 2832 embodies.
Ms. O'Mara, how big is the task force? Or was the task force?
I'd leave that to Mr. Dernberger.
Mr. Dernberger, how many people were on the task force?
Madam Chair, I believe we started out, quite frankly, when I started with this, there was no guidance. This wasn't created by statute, so there was no specific guidance on the makeup of the committee. I wanted to keep it relatively small to keep it manageable, but I found that as I started inviting people that I had known from my experience in my job, that as soon as I invited one person, they said, well, who else did you invite? And then they'd find out and they'd say, well, you know what, you're going to have to invite these other people. So it grew to a group of about 25, but frankly, by the end of 2009, our meetings had dwindled to where we had really a core of about a dozen people. So what's reflected in the report that was put out in February was really agreement reached among about a dozen people that were very evenly split among homeowners, insurance companies, representatives, their lobbyists, and builders and their lobbyists.
Mr. Dernberger, how often did you meet?
Once a month, beginning in August of 2009, and then we had a couple of almost back-to-back meetings in January and February to really try to put something together that we could get to the legislature to have put into a bill format.
Mr. Dernberger, were these meetings public meetings?
Yes, they were. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an attorney. I'm not familiar with like public meeting laws, but they were not secret. We made sure that there were people that were asked to be put on an email list that I maintained. As people were asked to be put on that, I added to them. Whenever we scheduled a meeting, every meeting we scheduled by agreement the next meeting. And then I followed that meeting up with an email to everybody in the group letting them know what we accomplished in that meeting and when the next meeting would be.
Thank you. Thank you both. Ms. O'Mara, please tell the other task force members that we appreciate their time and their input into the process.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, all of you, for the work that you've put into this bill. I just have one question. Section 3, when you were describing the bill, I thought I heard you say, Senator Saltzman, something about a mortgager who abandoned property being included in this. And and what it says in Section 3, if I'm looking at, I hope I'm looking at the, I was tracking with you on the engrossment on everything else you said, but it says a vendor does not include a subcontractor or a material supplier. I don't think there's anything about a mortgager there. So I'm just wondering if there was, if there's something else in the bill about this that I missed, or if this was a change in the engrossment.
I am looking at what would
Senator
be,
Saltzman?
I'm going off of the a summary of the bill, and if that is not in there, then I am incorrect. But I don't know if this, I don't remember taking that out, so it may be incorrect.
Ms. O'Meara or Mr. Dernberger?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Olson, I think the deletion of the language for the purpose of sale may operate to bring in mortgage lenders as you've described. That is my present understanding without doing a lot of checking back with the task force and the discussions that, that went into this particular deletion.
Thank you both. Is there anybody here who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Please come up to the table. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brenda Sorrow. I'm an attorney practicing in Edina, and I come here to offer you a perspective not only as an attorney that works exclusively with homeowners on these warranty claims, but also as a homeowner who went through a warranty claim herself. So I think I can offer a few perspectives. I do want to commend the committee. I think it was a good start, but I think it's premature at this time to move forward with legislation, and I'd like to articulate a few of those reasons for you. I know Senator Saltzman's done a great job for homeowners in the past. I just think there are a lot of pitfalls in the bill in front of you that are very adverse to homeowners. First of all, I know the committee is sometimes a little skeptical when attorneys show up. Quite frankly, if we just let this bill go through, I think it creates work for attorneys because the process that is so cumbersome that is now being forced upon homeowners will need an attorney, in my opinion, to explain it to them. It took me a while to kind of get my arms around what was going on here. The it's going to be costly. Non-binding arbitration has been tried in the court system, and nobody uses it anymore, because the stakeholders don't have to participate. What we hear in lawsuits from the builders is, it's not my fault, it's the fault of my subcontractor. Well, there's no requirements that the subcontractors show up here and participate, whereas if you're in a litigation or a more formal setting, they do participate financially. I'd like to just walk kind of through the bill a little bit. Section 1, Subdivision 4, that talks about preserving the statutory homeowner warranty claims. While there's an amendment proposed to 302A, there's no corresponding amendment to the statutory warranty law itself, 327A. So that's a problem right there. When you go to the inspection section, which is Section 4, it allows for a builder or the builder's designee to perform a visual or invasive inspection of a homeowner's property. And there is no requirement in the language proposed that the building be restored to its pre-inspection condition. What it says is that it needs to be patched or repaired to prevent future damage to the property. Now, I've seen a lot of these patches, and the committee probably can't see from a distance, but those patches are really ugly. They are very unsightly, and there is absolutely no requirement in this law that the builder or their designee, which is probably the insurance company, do anything to remedy that condition for the homeowner. What is an invasive inspection? Who's going to determine where that happens? What if the insurance company comes out and says, I want to cut on the inside of your home, which they do, I've been there, because it's less disruptive. What if there's mold in that wall cavity and you've got somebody with a cancer situation in the house? That is a serious health risk for those people. Not to mention they've just breached the internal vapor barrier underneath the drywall, which will cause performance problems with that home in the future. So that's one issue. Another large issue in my mind is Section 9, which talks about the fact that a vendor who does a repair on these homes does not then become a home improvement contractor. What that does then is say to the homeowner who did work together with their builder, and most of these repairs are extensive. I'm not talking about a tube of caulk. I'm talking about the builder that did the right thing, came out, took off all the stucco, brick, whatever, stripped the house down to the studs, rebuilt it, redid it. Right now, as the law stands, those homeowners have a warranty on that repair work. By taking those contractors out of the category of home improvement contractor, there is no warranty now on that repair. And there are a lot of homeowners that we've been able to negotiate a resolution like that with their builder that are going to be adversely affected, significantly affected by Section 9. Whereas if they'd just gone to another contractor for the repair, that contractor has to offer a 10-year warranty on that repair, which is very significant in these cases because these things don't tend to fail right away. It usually takes a period of years before we know if the repairs are going to be successful. So a homeowner who trusted that builder, even though the builder messed up once, said, okay, I'll work with you, going forward then has no warranty. With the homeowner disclosure law, that homeowner who went through the repair has to disclose the repair, but now under this statute has to disclose that repair has no warranty. I think those homeowners are going to have a heck of a time selling their house. And in this economy, I think that is a very real concern for all of your constituents. The neutral evaluation process, there's no parameters as to who these people are going to be. I mean, what are their qualifications going to be? We can get engineers that do these things day in and day out, and I've represented literally hundreds of homeowners in this situation. I can have an engineer tell me with a straight face that that 2x4 stud that's rotted and leaning over is in perfectly good shape. So who is going to be the person to give this qualified early neutral evaluation? The way these cases work is that they get in front of a good mediator, and a lot of the cases we handle don't end up in the court system. They get mediated without a lawsuit for good value for the homeowners, but you have to have good qualified mediators. But the difference between mediation and non-binding arbitration is very significant. In mediation, the people who are going to be affected, the homeowner, the builder, the insurance companies, come together and reach a resolution. They sign it. It's a done deal. It's binding. It ends. With a non-binding arbitration, it doesn't end. Whoever is displeased with the result of that arbitration can just keep going with it. So if you're really looking for a way to coalesce the process, and I think that that is a great goal for both the homeowners and the builder, I don't think that the non-binding arbitration is the way to go. I don't know how a homeowner is supposed to advocate his or her position without the help of an engineer at a minimum who's going to have to sit there all day and listen to the testimony of the other side and respond, and hopefully an attorney so that they present what's in essence a mini trial, even though it's not binding.
Ms. Laura, I have to say, though, that we do allow in the alternative process section for the parties to agree to an alternative dispute resolution process.
And I think that is good, Madam Chairman, but that requires agreement. If there is no agreement, if the biller says, nope, I want this qualified non-binding arbitration process, then there's no agreement. And the way I read the legislation is then you're opted back into that system. So I agree that that is a really good caveat. It's just, my overall view of this legislation is it's premature. The people on the committee, there were four homeowners. One dropped out. One lived in out-of-state. So my understanding is they couldn't be there. There were two homeowners' attorneys who asked to be on the committee who were denied to be on the committee because it was full. So, you know, I guess my position is, number one, either you table this bill so that people who advocate on behalf of homeowners can line up and talk about these things in the same terms as the lobbyists who were on the committee can do, or you either table it or you vote against this bill. I just think it's fraught with pitfalls for the homeowners.
Senator Saltzman, were there lobbyists on this committee only? I mean, I guess I wasn't aware of that, but thank you for your testimony, Ms.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. You know, a couple of points, Madam Chair. First of all, is that we did not specify the makeup of this committee, and because it was, you know, the bill was not signed by the governor, but I appreciate that it went forward. And I was apprised by the department that the process was starting. I was asked to submit names. I submitted a number of names, and I think that that is probably where the, you know, it started in terms of homeowners. And then when, you know, the committee was starting, I did contact two of the attorneys who had been quite involved in this process and said, are you following this working group? I didn't see your names listed on the email list. I had forwarded your names, just wanted to make sure you're in the loop. You know, in other words, I'm making sure that if they're not involved, can I help them in being involved? And the only response I received back was, thanks, Senator Saltzman. I appreciate your thinking of me. Never heard again. I did attend a meeting, and I saw one of the attorneys there. I have not received any correspondence from these two attorneys until today at, I think, around 11:30 and 3 o'clock. So I appreciate that, you know, there are so many people. This is such an emotional issue. And Ms. Sorrow, who is a constituent of mine, I did not hear from her until yesterday or the day before. So I'm really trying. We did our very, very best to reach out on this issue and involve many different people. I do want to also note, in terms of comments about who are these people who are, you know, the neutrals, I believe that it's spelled out in Section 10, lines 4.23, the panel of neutrals, is that the Department of Labor and Industry Commissioner shall maintain a list of persons who will serve as qualified neutrals. They shall, and there should be established requirements and qualifications for qualified neutrals, taking into account education, experience, and training of the applicant, potential conflicts of interest. So, you know, we aren't taking someone off the street. There is an attempt here to define who will be taking on these jobs. The other thing I do want to note is that on Section 5, on lines 2.26, and Ms. Sorrow has, you know, a good suggestion here in terms of any damage to property caused as a result of an inspection, I would certainly be open to an amendment that would be must be promptly repaired to pre-inspection condition by the inspecting party, period. So it's not just to prevent further damage, so it's a temporary patch or something over a house, but that we do restore that to the pre-existing condition.
Want to move that? I'll be happy to move that language, Madam Chair. And then I had a question.
Madam Chair, though?
Senator Higgins?
I think it's not the pre-inspection condition. I think it's the pre-damage condition.
Pre-damage. Very good.
Something like that.
Madam Chair?
No, Senator Higgins, no. I think it's pre-inspection. They're repairing the damage that they make happen because of going in to do the inspection.
But isn't the home already damaged?
But, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, this is, for example, they drill into walls, I think, to look for mold. They move, I mean, they may remove a panel or something. The damage that we're talking about here, I believe, is the damage when they're actually doing the inspecting. Not the damage
by the inspector.
Right, yeah. Right. Not the damage. Sorry. To the home from whatever the underlying cause is.
Senator also moves the language that will be read by Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, if I was tracking this right, it would be on page 2, line 28, delete to prevent further damage to the property. And then you want to insert to restore the property to pre-inspection condition.
That work, Senator Saltzman?
It would.
Right. On that motion.
Say it again.
Ms. Pontius, could you repeat it on line 2.28?
Madam Chair, delete the language before the period and then just insert to restore the property to pre-inspection condition.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Senator Saltzman?
I'm not sure. I know there's been some questions about patched or repaired, and I think we want it repaired. So it's clear that it's not
so just delete patched or.
So right, correct, Madam Chair.
So on line 2.27, delete patched or. And then on line 20.28, delete the entire line to the period and insert before the period the language that says, Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, to restore the property to its pre-inspection condition.
And Senator Olson moves that language. Any discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Olson, one question, and I think we're ready to move the bill. Senator
okay.
Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to quickly respond with a question regarding Section 9. Because of all the comments that were made, I won't go through and share my thoughts on all of them, but the one that I was the most concerned about was Subdivision 8 of Section 9, effect of certain actions. Because I would not want to be supporting a bill that was going to eliminate an existing warranty. And so I guess I'm not sure that that's what that language actually does do, but I want to clarify that because I don't think we want to do that. I don't want to do that. Just, you know, it would be kind of like if you have a warranty on something and you take it in and bring it back and get another one to replace it, usually your warranty is still going to follow that replacement. And with a house, the same way, you would want to continue to have the same warranty you had in the beginning and not diminish it by the fact that there needed to be a repair. And so I need to clarify that comment and make sure that that's not what we're doing.
Senator Saltzman?
On that point, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, perhaps I could refer you back to lines 2.29, Section B. It's my understanding that this part of the bill would that if there is a warranty in place that when you start the process that the warranty would essentially go on hold and then continue once the repair is made, so that you wouldn't necessarily get a new warranty but that your warranty would continue for the original length. And maybe Ms. Pontius, if that language is, am I interpreting that correctly? This would be on lines 2.29 through 2.29.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I think that language is addressed to tolling the statute of limitations, not to the liability issue itself or who would be responsible. And so the Section 9 language, to me, raises the concern that let's just say that an insurer or a vendor or somebody, basically that example of bringing the house down to the studs and basically rebuilding it. Does that now mean that there's that the original builder still is the responsible party in terms of the warranty? And is that a correct, is that the policy we're trying to make sure we're establishing here?
Yes, it is,
and
Madam Chair.
And
yes.
If that would already be existing law, then do we even need this language? Because I think what I'm concerned about is that we're not diminishing any liability here. And so I'm just wondering if we even need that section.
Senator Saltzman?
So perhaps Mr. Durenberger could help with that.
Mr. Durenberger, is this comfort language or do we need this?
Madam Chair, and I'm not an attorney again, and this my understanding is that all this was trying to do is clarify that, as Senator Olson had indicated, the warranty that was offered by the original builder remains in force regardless of the work that's repaired. It's all it's trying to clarify is that when the insurance company gets involved and they're funding the repairs, that now the insurance company doesn't step in and become a vendor and then be subject to the requirements of 327A. Similarly, a subcontractor doesn't now also become a vendor or a home improvement contractor where now they've got this brand new warranty that starts and move forward.
Madam Chair, may I just address that point briefly?
Ms. Sorrow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is with paragraph C under Section 9, because if you say that a vendor does not become a home improvement contractor, a vendor only offers a warranty on the from the day 1 to year 10. If the home is fixed in year 9 by a home improvement contractor, that home improvement contractor under 327A has to extend a 10-year warranty on that repair.
And by saying a vendor doesn't become a home improvement contractor, then if the vendor is the one that does the repair in year 9, there is no warranty, 10-year warranty starting on that repaired scenario. So that is my concern. And there are a lot of homeowners that I've represented that I know of, my neighbor's one of them, who, you know, thinks he bought a home that has a 10-year warranty on the repair, and the way this is, he won't, because a vendor won't qualify as a home improvement contractor anymore.
Senator Saltzman?
So we could take Section 9 out, I've been informed. It was to clarify, it was to address something, but if it's more sort of comfort language, if people are more comfortable not having it in there, that is perfectly fine. It would still be
Senator Olson moves to strike Section 9 from the bill. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
I believe there's some individuals who would like to speak on the bill. I would encourage you, in consideration to the bulk of the work the committee has to do, that if you could either be concise or not repeat the same points that others have made, that would be helpful. Is it just the two of you? Or is anybody else? Very good. Please proceed. State your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Nancy Johnson, and I'm a homeowner who has been volunteering in this area for a long time, and we have a loosely formed group called Minnesota Home Watch, and it's made up of homeowners, attorneys, and engineers, and construction people, and we have been working in the past too with Senator Saltzman on the bills that were passed last year. I do know about this committee. I've been in touch with a couple of the homeowners that are on the committee, and I think certainly the intention is good to try and sort of come to some sort of agreement. But I would like to read an email here that was sent from one of our homeowners, Paul Stutler, to Charlie Durenberger at Dolly yesterday. And then I guess I would, I'll just go ahead with that, and that's all I'm going to do. And again, this is from Paul Stutler to Charlie Durenberger, and it's dated Wednesday, March 10th, 4:54:03 p.m. And Paul writes, "As I wrote yesterday, you characterized my agreement accurately. With the bills not having been reviewed in the working group, I have been receiving all sorts of questions and commentary from others that has pointed out important things. At this point, I do not support the bills for the following reasons. The right of inspection for the builder does not have any protections for the homeowner. That is, the builder could make cuts in the wall, etc., and end up not repairing them. This is a big catch, and I regret that we did not catch it earlier."
So, Ms. Johnson, members, we took care of that concern. Ms. Johnson? We took care of that concern with the amended language.
"The home improvement aspect, whereby the warranty does not get extended, basically kills the whole idea for me. I had argued."
Ms. Johnson, we also fixed that by deleting Section 9.
Okay. And then he goes on to say that he would never accept the original builder's plan for that reason, because of the warranty. "Therefore, unless that is added, I am against both bills as they add process and cost to a homeowner. And I would never advise a friend to take the builder's repair specifically for the warranty extension issue. Therefore, it's a waste of time and money to force the homeowner to go through the process leading to no warranty extension. Without nor tolling the statutes, an arbitration process should not be mandatory. If we can get the inspection cost protection and the home warranty items fixed, he would support the legislation." There was another homeowner, Ed Seifert, and Paul Stutler, and Nancy Emerson and I, and Scott, or Patrick Leo Halloran, and a couple engineers that met with Representative Carolyn Lane in February, along with Representative Steve Simon. And at that meeting, there were two things we wanted to talk about. One was the fact that our group was not going to actively work with any bills or ask legislators to bring forth bills, because we knew it was because of what happened last spring with the veto on 5 out of the 6 bills, plus we also knew the legislature had a very busy year this year. But the other issue was also the consensus from those two homeowners, or their opinion was that there was not good consensus on some of these issues. You've addressed and talked about Paul's here, and Ed, who could not be here, had some grave concerns about the legislation as well. I guess my own personal request would be that the bill would be tabled for now, and that there would be some additional time given to work out the issues. We got a copy of the bill from one of our homeowners last week and sent it out to our list members for review, and that is where some of these questions have come up. And so I would ask that you table the bill.
Ms. Johnson, now that we have taken care of those issues, you still have the mind that we should table the bill?
These were Paul Stutler's comments. I would like Ed Seifert, who is the other homeowner on the committee, to be involved in a discussion on the bill. He couldn't be here. He's been copied on the emails, but he's been extraordinarily busy and was not able to attend. And so I would like, he was one of the very active homeowners that attended many of the sessions, and so I would like there to be some time for him to give feedback and comment as well.
Madam Chair. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that having addressed Mr. Stutler's concerns, according to his letter, he says he now supports the bill since we did take care of those two things. And just to comment, you know, for your understanding, because I really respect the work that you've done, but I think Senator Saltzman wants to provide some protection for homeowners, and that we have no, we have a deadline that we have to meet, so this is kind of our only opportunity to do that. Nobody knows what would happen again next year, but I think if we're going to try to put that protection for homeowners in place, it's important for us to move forward with this.
I understand that, but we've been working on this issue, many of us, since probably 2002, 2003. And again, if there can be a delay just to get some feedback. My understanding was that there were two attorneys that asked to be on that committee that are volunteer for our group, and they were told that the committee was full and they were not allowed to actively participate, but they did attend, I think, a couple of times. It was a very rigorous process, and for everybody that participated, I think that was really good. I personally had a concern about the number of lobbyists that were on that committee. But having said that, again, I would defer on a response to you, Senator Olson, by just saying that I would like to see it tabled.
The other witness, please. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Nancy Emerson. I live at 8750 Concord Court, Invergrove Heights, Minnesota. Madam Chair, Senators, I, with Nancy Johnson and the group that she mentioned as Minnesota Home Watch, have been working on homeowner bills for 6 years. And we had the good fortune, due diligence after pounding the halls and talking to all of you and all the representatives, we did have the great good fortune after 6 years to be able to pass all the bills, which Governor Pawlenty vetoed 5 of the 6 bills. I'm extremely distressed that we've been kept out of the loop with all of this. We only learned that probably a week ago that any of this was occurring. I myself am very disappointed. We learned from Ed Seifert, who was asked to be on this committee, this homeowner task force. He originally told us in an email that he was the only homeowner to be asked on this
Ms. Emerson,
committee.
Ma'am, I know that you've taken the time out to join us, and I greatly appreciate your being part of the committee process. If you have some concerns about the end product, we could work with you, as we have done with Ms. Sorrell, to address the specific areas of the bill, if we can. If you have a concern about the process, that's kind of outside the purview of this committee, and so we can't help you with the process.
I know.
So are there specific concerns about the end product of the bill? Is there a specific language here that we can help you address?
I believe that the language is skewed based on the composition of the committee towards the builders. We've seen all this stuff in the past. I concur with Nancy Johnson that this needs to be tabled. I'm pretty distressed about the whole thing, that we were told by the committee members, homeowners Paul and Ed, that there was a consensus paper in the meeting that was going to be, that they didn't agree with. No one was ever told, including our homeowners, that there was going to be an attempt to turn it into a bill without any discussion or anybody being notified that this was billed. So I have to ask that I agree with Nancy Johnson. This needs to be tabled until it can be thoroughly reviewed by our side, because for all practical purposes, that committee has been our adversaries for the last 6 years.
Thank you for your input. Senator Saltzman.
You know, with respect to Mr. Durenberger, I'd like to give him just a few seconds to respond, because I think that there's been some comments made about the process, and I want to tell you how much I respect the work that he did. And I know when he went into it, he was very hesitant to get involved. And what he put into this to make this a fair process, I just would like him just – I think we would all feel better if he could just respond for just a few seconds.
Senator Saltzman, he may. I don't think that the committee is going to vote or not vote on the product of the bill based on the process.
Right.
We don't have any control over that. Right. And, you know, I'm grateful that the citizens have shown up to voice their concern. But we only have control of the language that's before us. So, Mr. Durenberger, thank you for all the good work that you've done on this. I understand, based on your testimony, that you've tried to make the process as open as possible. There will always be people who feel that they've been excluded from the process. I'm more concerned about the end product and making sure that it does what you intend for it to do, Senator Saltzman, and I think we've had ample testimony on that. Any further discussions on Senate File 2832 as amended? Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 2832 as amended. Right, 2832 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Saltzman.
Chair.
Senator Sieben. Senate File 1590.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Members, this bill has been through two committees already, and it deals with inflatable amusement equipment. And just for members who weren't on any of the previous two committees, as way of background, the inflatable amusement equipment industry is growing in Minnesota, and as I found out from a constituent of mine, it is currently unregulated. And so what this bill attempts to do is put in place safety standards, require insurance, require supervision of the rides, and require the owners of inflatable equipment rides to register with the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm happy to go through the bill section by section if you would like, and then I do have a couple of amendments too.
Please, Senator Sieben.
Would you like me to go through the bill?
Yes.
So Section 1 has different definitions that you can see there. I would point out that this legislation does not include this does not include places that are does not include rental equipment. So for instance, if you rent one of those big inflatable things and put it in your backyard, this does not cover that. I just point that out. And then in subdivision 2, it just says that you have to comply with the section. Subdivision 3 states that, and some of this language was amended in Commerce Committee to say that uninflatable, which again, just for members, is like one of those big jumper things or a inflatable slide, means that it has to be placed in a manner that complies with the ASTM standards. ASTM standards, members, just for your understanding, is the American Society for Testing and Materials, which are developed in conjunction with the manufacturers and the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So this explicitly references those standards as it relates to padding around the individual rides. Subdivision 4 is the one that we would like to change in response to some of the concerns we heard from the Pump It Up company. Subdivision 5 requires insurance. Subdivision 6 requires registration and a registration fee for $100 for a two-year period with the Department of Labor and Industry. And then Subdivision 7 is the Department of Labor and Industry's enforcement oversight. I do have two testifiers who would like to comment on the bill, but I don't know, Madam Chair, if you'd like me to ask a member to move my amendments first.
Let's, because I know people have people have concerns about the bill, let's look at the amendments so that we have the bill as before us. Would you like for us to look at both of those amendments, and then maybe you can go through the two amendments with us, or which amendment do you want?
Yes, Madam Chair. Why don't we start with the A-10 amendment? And as it's being distributed, members, I will explain what it does. So if you look under Subdivision 4 on lines 2.7 to 2.10, on lines 2.9 and 2.10, it says that the ratio of supervisors to inflatables must be no less than 1. And we heard from industry who said that that standard was too rigid. And so instead, what we propose to do is to use the language that's in Subdivision 3 as it relates to the ASTM standards. Because, again, the ASTM standards are developed with industry's input at the federal level with the Consumer Product Safety Commission to help give guidance over how these rides should be operated. So the amendment, as you'll see, deletes the words be no less than 1 on lines 2.10 and instead references the ASTM standards.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I would move the A-10 amendment. I think that's a really important improvement because as the standards change, you don't want our statute to be stuck at a standard that is no longer the industry standard. So I hope we'll adopt the A-10 amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sieben, is the ASTM organization, are they the only organization in the United States that does testing and Senator, material?
Senator Sieben, the Consumer Product Safety Commission also gives input to the American Society for Testing and Materials. So I guess the answer is no. They're not the only organization.
And Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, the question further question would be is I don't know what the standards of the ASTM are, so I'm a little at a loss of you want me to approve standards based on another organization, and there may even be a further organization somewhere else that may do this type of work. I'm not sure what I'm really voting on now.
Madam Chair,
Senator Sieben.
And Senator Limmer, other states have adopted similar legislation which references the ASTM standards. I'll just say by way of background, too, many years back I passed crib safety legislation that relates to the safety of cribs that are used in daycare centers in Minnesota, and that had similar reference to the ASTM standards because, again, they're developed in conjunction with the Consumer Product Safety Commission where the manufacturers have input into the development of what they are. The standards are quite long, and as Senator Ortman said, they do they do change as the rides change, for instance, or as additional issues come up. But there's, as it relates to supervision of trained personnel, it gives guidelines or suggestions of how many supervisors there should be per inflatable, for example. And we certainly can hear from some of the industry representatives, but like I said, they were more comfortable with having this language in the legislation than an explicit staff ratio.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I have an A8 amendment, I think it is, yes, that is specific. Could I ask Senator Seaman, did you say what the ASTM standard is today? I thought you said something, but I wasn't listening as fast as you were speaking, maybe. But
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, we do have a copy of it. It's pretty long. I mean, it's two pages. But I'm happy to just, if you want to hear what some of it is in it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering about the proportion of supervisors present at the inflatables. That's because that's what this is about, right?
Right. It is, Madam Chair.
Senator Seaman?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but as you'll remember, Senator Scheid, as we discussed, I believe it was in your committee, different rides sometimes also have different staff ratios that are recommended. So, for instance, if there is a really large ride, it may require more or less supervision depending on the scope of it. So that's also why I feel it's better to reference the ASTM standards, because they don't explicitly lay out what a particular ratio is, because it's dependent on the different type of what the inflatable is. But
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I may, are there inflatable rides as well? Mm-hmm. Is that part of – these are rides? These aren't just – I mean, I don't know. I thought they were slides and jumping things, and but they're things that they're called rides with moving parts.
Senator Olson
and Madam Chair, I've taken my grandkids to these, and they call them rides in the sense that everything at the county fair would be called a ride, but you go inside of it and jump on it, and you have a ticket like you do for other rides. So it's probably a little different than you think of most rides, but.
And Senator Seaman?
Madam Chair, here is is the most clear example of how I see in the ASTM standard. It says, the operators of inflatable amusement devices shall provide the appropriate number of attendants according to a minimum specified by the manufacturer to effectively manage and monitor activities on the inflatable device during operations.
So,
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, so you're saying that that would be the standard then, whatever the manufacturer is recommending. I'd like to ask somebody, before we vote on this, I'd like to ask somebody in the industry to, you know, in this business to speak to that.
Senator Scheid, Senator Ortman has moved the A-10 amendment, but I'm going to, the reason why I asked Senator Seaman to put the amendments out there is that I thought it would be important to have the amendments on the table for the discussion from her witnesses, as well as for purpose of discussion from the industry people who are here to testify, so that we know that Senator Seaban has taken into consideration some of the concerns from the industry, and that way they, too, can also speak to the amendments we have before us. And then once we're finished with the testimony, we can go back and make a decision on the amendments. Senator Seaban, do you want to proceed with your two testifiers?
Yes, and Madam Chair, I still would like at some point then to talk about or to discuss the other amendment, too.
There is another amendment.
Right.
All right. And which amendment
is
that?
That's the A9 amendment.
All right. So let's look at the A9 amendment. Let's pass that one out.
Members and Madam Chair, this issue came to my attention after the bill left the previous two committees. And what it says is essentially what it says is a waiver of liability signed by or on behalf of a minor for injuries arising out of the commercial use of an inflatable is void. And the reason that this came up is because, as it was pointed out to me, Most of these facilities have waivers that parents sign saying that if there's an injury, the operator of the facility is not held liable, even if it is, regardless of who is liable. So it was pointed out to me that there's a similar bill moving through the Senate right now that Senator Murphy is carrying, saying that parent trucking companies cannot force their independent truckers to sign a liability, saying that they would have no liability if there was an injury by that truck driver, and that's moving favorably through the Senate. So I would hope that this would be similar to that, just saying that a parent cannot sign away the liability for their child.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sieben talked to me about this amendment before the committee hearing, and this is probably going to be an overgeneralization, but my recollection in an overly generalized way is that usually when these kinds of
then is it valuable for consumption, Senator Olson?
Well, I think it is, because I'm just saying it's not quite this black and white, but as a general rule, I don't think these waivers of liability usually have effect, but they create a lot of confusion and they create a lot of potential arguments between insurance companies and delay in taking responsibility, and perhaps give parents the false impression. I mean, if it's not really going to be generally upheld anyway, I think it's a good idea to not have those kinds of statements in this kind of a form, because it just kind of sets up a false standard or impression for people. So I definitely support this amendment, and I would like to offer it at the appropriate time.
Well, in an overly general kind of a way, that was a generally reasonable comment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Orman.
Madam Chair. I am inclined not to support the amendment, generally speaking, because it does put parents on notice. When you walk into a facility and you are asked to sign a waiver, hopefully those parents are reading the waiver and realize that there is a risk when they let their kids go. And there is a risk when they are no longer supervising their children. What they're really doing is allowing somebody else to supervise according to somebody else's standards. And I think if you take away, I mean, maybe you can't accomplish everything you'd want to here, but when you no longer require the waiver, I think you'll lose that ability to educate the parents.
Let's come back to argue the amendment when we take up the amendment. Let's move to the testifiers then we'll have plenty of time to debate the merits of each of the amendments. Let's see. Is it Ms. Jennifer Rosenberger?
Do you want to go first?
May I go first?
Are Ms.
Lisa Schmidt? Correct.
Please proceed. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Lisa Schmidt, and I'm from Victoria. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. In 2008, my 5-year-old son Ryan was seriously injured at an indoor inflatable party zone called Pump It Up. He was bouncing at the base of an inflatable 20-foot-tall commercial slide when he went over the side, landing headfirst on commercial-grade carpeting lying directly on concrete. He suffered a skull fracture and a brain injury, and he has recovered but will never know the lasting long-term effects of his injury. The night of my son's injury, there were no trained attendants in the room of 4 inflatables. Ryan's injury isn't an isolated or freak accident. A pattern has been developing. Other Minnesota children have also been seriously injured at Pump It Up. In 2007, 8-year-old Carter Justice of Plymouth suffered a shattered skull and brain injury when he went off the top of an inflatable slide and hit the floor, and the back of his head shattered like an eggshell. He spent 5 days in intensive care. In 2009, just this last fall, 7-year-old Andrew Fashing of Chaska suffered a broken arm so badly that he required surgery and a hospital stay when he played on an obstacle course at Pump It Up, and another child had to go seek the assistance of an attendant. In 2008, 8-year-old Grant Rosenberger of South St. Paul suffered a brain injury on an inflatable. No adults witnessed this accident, and the doctors and parents had to rely on the testimony of other children at the birthday party to try to piece together what happened and why their son was unconscious. In 2005, 10-year-old Alon Zitzer of Plymouth suffered a fractured arm when an employee, not following the rules or the standards, came down the slide and crashed into him and broke his arm. Our amusement park law, 184B, makes no reference to these inflatable rides, but they are indeed inflatable rides, and ASTM governs them, and the committee that governs them are all within the inflatable amusement ride group. So they are classified as amusement rides. Clearly, the lack of a law in our state requiring these businesses to operate is putting the safety of children at serious, serious risk. Families are unknowingly signing waivers, giving up their legal rights, and dropping their kids off at birthday parties where they're assuming that these rides are being monitored by trained attendants that the inflatable rides are required to have by the manufacturer. There isn't a single inflatable manufacturer in this country that says it's okay to operate an inflatable amusement ride without a properly trained operator. Well, what is a trained operator? The manufacturer requires the operator to have read the manual for the inflatable ride before operating it. The ASTM standard spells out exactly what the rules are. You wouldn't expect a parent to be able to run a roller coaster or a tilt-a-whirl without proper training any more than we would expect you on the committee to be able to run one of these inflatable rides. So there are serious hidden dangers when operating inflatable amusement rides that are not intuitive to a parent. For example, how many people can be on an inflatable slide at one time, a 20-foot inflatable slide? I wonder if anyone knows the answer to that question. What are the weight and height restrictions? What is the proper way to enter the ride, to actually ride it, and then exit the inflatable? Each inflatable has different requirements. The business's current system of relying on parents, birthday party parents, and employees that have not received proper training clearly is not working in Minnesota. The company's current policy, when and if it's ever even followed, has resulted in 5 known serious injuries, and this is all we even know about at this point. This, in my opinion, is unacceptable and irresponsible. We, the mothers of hurt children, could just let this go. Well, let me back up for a second. I would like to submit, if it's okay, a picture of the first time Ryan was at a birthday party at Pump It Up. He was 2 years old. He did not meet the height requirements for the slide. He was on the slide along with 3 other children going down the slide at the same time, which is a safety violation. There are 2 children up at the top and 5 more people going up the steps, including an adult. You are never to mix sizes of people on inflatables. It's a recipe for disaster. Please. The rules for the slide are that there should be no more than 4 people on the slide at one time, 1 person going down at a time. There's a proper way to go down the slide, and you can see from the photograph that at this party where trained attendants were present, this just isn't happening. Okay, so we mothers of hurt children could just let this go, never allowing our own children to ever play at these dangerous places again. But it's not okay that the business is continuing to operate unsafely. We are now concerned with protecting other Minnesota children from the dangerous lack of trained operators that each and every inflatable requires. There is a role for government when it comes to the safety of children. I have heard many parents, industry experts, and politicians call this common sense legislation. Tragically, 18-year-old Seth Kilstadius from Two Harbors died on May 21st of 2004 when flipping from the top of an inflatable slide in a school gymnasium. This bill does not currently seek to regulate the inflatable rental industry, but we feel strongly that any Minnesota company in business specifically for the profit of the play of young children, young impulsive children, should absolutely be required by law to follow the manufacturer's equipment requirements, their own industry standards, and the guidelines of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. We have to protect our children. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rosenberger?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jennifer Rosenberger from South St. Paul. I want you first to think of your grandchildren or your children at home, nieces or nephews, or neighborhood kids that you see playing. Now, when you picture them running around, jumping, playing, that's what my son was doing 15 minutes before he left for a birthday party. Birthday party. I was not there, but I signed a waiver that said there was going to be trained people watching out for my children. My son Grant left for a fun-filled birthday party at Pump It Up. The next thing I knew, I had a phone call at 7:57 from my friend that Grant wanted me. He fell and hit his head. Mother's instinct was to go get him. I had a baby who was nursing and hungry, so my husband, who was running errands, dropped everything to go to Pump It Up. At 8:07, I called to ask them how to get there and how Grant was doing. 15 minutes later, my friend called me. My friend called me. Not one phone call from Pump It Up yet. They called me. I could hear my son screaming in the background, a scream I have never heard and still to this day have not heard from him. I immediately told my friend to call 911. So here's the first problem I have. 911 was called from my friend's cell phone. So if there was enough trained staff walking around that day, someone should have been with my child when he was laying on the floor, waving his arms and legs like a baby and crying. Someone should have met my husband at the front door and told him what had happened. Someone should have met the EMTs at the front door. Someone should have been there from Pump It Up, a business that I sent my child to have fun. No one from Pump It Up ever met any of us at the door, including the EMTs. Next, my husband got there. Grant was lying on the floor. He couldn't stand. He was screaming like a baby, waving his arms and his arms over his head. Now, the EMTs said they were waiting to see if his response would change when his dad or me got there, as some kids, you know, like when mom or dad gets there, they settle down a little. No response was different. My husband totally picked him up and looked at the EMT and said, "We've got to go right now, nearest hospital." Again, where are these trained staff? Where is this person that I signed a waiver that they were supposed to be watching him? Nowhere. Trained staff, supervision, huge part of this bill, and I hope you all take in consideration my story, because there was a supervisor there. It could have been prevented, possibly. It could have been lessened. Maybe it would have been a concussion instead of a moderate brain injury with a brain bleed. In the ambulance, Grant was unresponsive many times and unconscious. The doctors tried to have IVs in, and he was trying to rip them out as fast as he could get them in. He had two CTs, as the first one didn't quite take. His blood pressure was rocketing, and his oxygen count was going down. When I got there, he had no idea who I was. No idea. Looked right at through me like I was, could have been the stranger that he passed in the shopping store. 1 minute, he would look, open his eyes. The next minute, he'd be out again. Next minute, open his eyes, screaming bloody murder, trying to rip things out. The next minute, out again. This was pretty much how our entire night went. The doctors made the choice to move him to HCMC, a head trauma. We all knew this was not a good sign. He had bleeding on his brain, and HCMC knew how to deal with it better than Fairview Ridges in Burnsville. On the way to HCMC, again, Grant was unresponsive and unconscious. When they got to HCMC, another CT to find out if there's more bleeding going on than was at Fairview Ridges. So basically up to the PIC unit, and it was a big waiting game all night long. So I had a nursing baby. They put us up in a room, and I had to fly back and forth between nursing her and being at the bedside of my 8-year-old son, because I had no idea what the next hour was going to bring, more or less the next 2 days. 4 a.m., Grant mumbled, "Mom." And I truly was the happiest day of my life. I jumped up. He had a 24-hour nurse at his side, and I said, "I think he just said my name. He said my name." I went running in the other room to get my husband and get my mom and my aunts and everyone else who was up there. And for that instant, that was a turning point for us. It was something that was turning good. Every hour got incredibly better. A mom turned into a, "Oh, hi," and then out again. And then we couldn't wake him. He would have little moments like that, and then he'd be out for a half hour. To this day, Grant still has what I call problems. His mood has changed. He gets frustrated very easy. We have 5 children in our family, so just on an average, getting frustrated can happen. But for someone who has a moderate brain injury at age 8, and a brain injury does not heal like a broken arm, he will have this brain injury over his head for the rest of his life. He gets upset faster, and he cries at the drop of a hat.
These are things that we have to cope with. These are things that I have to try to teach a 10-year-old how to cope with. It's a very difficult thing, and it's ongoing. Tomorrow he could wake up with seizures. He could have other disabilities that arise. So we're not out of the woods from this head injury. I can't stand by and let other children get hurt or other mothers sign a waiver thinking that there is supervision going on. There is not. There needs to be a trained staff. They need to follow the rules of these inflatables. It'd be like all of us driving around, if we want to go 80, we can go 80. Who cares? There's no laws. Grant was at a birthday party at Pump It Up. That tells parents to relax. We'll take care of it. We'll watch your kids. I urge you to really think about the supervision part of this. I know this is the big part that people are concerned about. The standards that they make for these inflatables are for the safety of the inflatables. It's like the standards when you buckle your kids in seat belts or buckle them in car seats. There is standards for them. This is exactly the same thing. So I urge you to just really think you're protecting kids. That's all this bill is doing, protecting kids.
Thank you both very much. Thank you. We have a couple other testifiers who would like to speak on this bill. So if, let's have Mr. Baker and then Mr. Wally. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Baker. I am the Director of Safety and Site Development for PIU Management. PIU Management is the parent company and the franchisor of the brands Pump It Up and Bounce You. If you're not familiar with our brands, we are what's classified as a children's entertainment center, also known as a family entertainment center, with our primary business being that of inflatable rides or inflatable games that the kids can play on. I'm here today representing not only the national brand, but also to my left are the owners of the five individual Pump It Up businesses that are in the metropolitan area. It is our understanding that the purpose of this bill is to somehow or to oversee for the safety of children. And I sit before you, I'd like to state that that is our objective as well. As the National Safety Director, I also oversee the site development department of this business. And with approximately 222 locations nationwide, we have designed every one of these buildings in-house. We have done that because there are certain parameters that we are not willing to accept to have someone on the outside, you know, designing the flow and designing where the staff can stand to oversee the inflatables. I also work directly with our manufacturers, one of which happens to be a manufacturer here in Eagan, Minnesota, who also works very closely with us to manufacture games that are designed specifically for the indoor inflatable industry, because the indoor inflatable industry is, as a whole, completely separate than that of the outdoor rental industry. I'd like to begin by, like I said, first stating that we support this bill. We absolutely support the safety of children on a global scale. We have two primary concerns with the bill as it's written. The first was the initial ratio of the one-to-one attendant to inflatable rides, or the operator to inflatable rides. It's my understanding that that amendment language has been changed by Senator Sieben, and I'd like to personally thank her for having the initiative to speak to us and to kind of allow us to speak from a professional industry standpoint. And we fully support the First Amendment to change the language to read in compliance with the ASTM guidelines. We certainly have no argument with that at all. The second, and I guess there's really one other small one, and that's not really small, but I'd like to touch base on it, and that is that to support a bill that is, you know, put to the committee as being for the safety of children, but then to specifically exclude the outdoor rental industry is disturbing to us. And I choose that word carefully because I don't want to overstate it. But the truth is, in the Consumer Product Safety Commission reports, information that we have and that I can certainly supply to the committee supports this, the indoor inflatable industry as a whole is considerably, statistically, around 9.5 to 10 times safer than the outdoor industry. And by that, I mean the Consumer Product Safety Commission report of 2009 reflects approximately 22 incidents that require medical care for every million kids that play on inflatables. The indoor industry, our industry, is approximately 2.4 injuries per million children. So if you are looking at a bill that truly is intended to offer safety to children playing on inflatables, to exclude roughly 90% of the children that will play on inflatable rides and devices, I would ask that you at least consider that, because the truth of the matter is, while accidents happen, and I can certainly sympathize anytime an accident does happen, the fact that the statistics support that very few accidents by comparison to the industry as a whole happen in the indoor industry is certainly something to consider. Pump It Up is a business that started roughly 9 years ago. I believe the first store opened in 2000 in the year 2000 and began franchising 2003. And we pioneered the industry. We are hands down far and above the largest in the industry with 222 locations. The closest to us are companies that you may be familiar with, a company called Monkey Joe's, a company called Jump Zone, have approximately 25 to 30 facilities. The reason I bring this up is because we certainly understand the industry, I would like to believe, better than anyone else. And so for the committee to offer, you know, me the opportunity to come here and testify, and also to the senators that took time out of their busy day the last 2 days to listen to us and to offer their ear, so to speak, for us to make a point and to try to get our opinion on the record, I genuinely appreciate that. To the amendment of the waiver, this is a waiver or an amendment that, quite frankly, we would not be amenable to, and we would protest for two primary reasons. I'd like to address the purpose of our waiver, and I believe there was a sampling of a waiver that was part of this bill, and I'd like to make certain that the committee understands that's not our waiver. That's a waiver for another business. Our waiver serves two purposes. The first purpose is to notify or to inform the consumer of risks associated with our industry. And certainly, if you remove that notification or that warning, it sets a rather dangerous precedent, not only for those that are attending, but I also think that it sets an unfortunate precedent that, well, if a waiver isn't necessary, then perhaps it's a safe place to play. And that's not to imply that it's not a safe place to play. I just think that a waiver is something that is certainly important enough to notify people of the inherent risks of doing anything. It's very likely that you have kids that are playing hockey or that are playing local sports. And it's also just as likely that you've signed a waiver for these kids to play those sports. And our business is no different. So the first part of our waiver is to notify the consumer of the risks involved in our industry. The second part of our waiver is to indemnify our owners of the negligent acts of others. It was testified earlier that our waiver, basically by signing our waiver, that we are not held liable, and that is simply not the case. As many of the members may know, there is nothing that a parent can sign to sign away the rights of not only a minor but of anyone to sue or to file litigation or a claim for negligent acts. Quite frankly, that's not what our waiver does. What our waiver stipulates is that in the unlikely event that somebody outside of our specific control, in other words, a non-employee or a guest that we have no control over, does something injurious to another party in our building, that we are not responsible. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean that the person who is injured can't also sue us for that. I believe it was Senator Olson that mentioned that you certainly can put forth a lawsuit for any, basically for anything, and I'm paraphrasing, forgive me, but that, you know, the waiver doesn't necessarily mean I will not sue or I cannot sue. It simply indemnifies our owners from the negligent acts of others. Nowhere in our waiver does it state that you can't sue us if we're negligent. Certainly, if we do something wrong, we need to be held accountable. Again, I would close by saying that we certainly support legislation. We support anything that makes our industry safer. I appreciate the time of the committee and certainly, the time of the senators that gave us an ear today. And with that, I just say thank you and answer any questions you may have.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I just would have to, I'd like to address my comments to the amendment, the waiver. There's a big difference between a permission slip and a waiver of liability. In most sports, parents sign permission. There's also something you can do without waiving liability that would say, I acknowledge and I've been informed of the risks. Here's what they are. You tell the parent, these are the risks. And in spite of those risks, I'm giving my child the permission to ride on this ride. I mean, that would address any of the concerns that were raised in terms of a parent being responsible for the making this decision, making sure that the parent knows the kinds of things that, that they might be exposing their child to. But you go beyond that. You say that you freely assume all of the risks, which is contrary to law, and yet you're putting this in writing and having people sign it, so you're giving them a false impression of their ability to be to hold you accountable under the law. And you say even if arising, both known and unknown, even if arising from the negligence of others, and you go on to say that the person signing this releases and holds harmless, that's a release, that's different than what you said you were having people do.
Madam Chair.
Pump it up and so forth. So forth and so on, from any claims and injuries and so forth.
Senator Ortman wants to make a point.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out, Senator Olson, that I think the testifier said this is not his waiver.
Madam Chair, this and this specifically says pump it up right on the attachment.
Madam Chair, the flyer that or the sheet that's in your packet is not from Pump It Up. It's from House of Bounce. However, Senator Olson, I gave her a copy of a Pump It Up liability waiver, so she has another one that was explicitly from Pump It Up that Ms. Schmidt had that she gave to me. But you're right, this is a different one.
Thank you. I'm sorry for interrupting. I just was not able to follow along here.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson,
and I'm sorry because I saw that too. And during as I was asking Senator Sieben if she had a copy of their waiver because I wanted to look at it to track with what the witness was saying, and so I did get a copy of it, which you guys haven't seen.
Right.
And it does specifically state that it's expects the parent to waive liability, is what it's saying, which is not the law and creating confusion. And it's not just a permission slip. It's not a notice of danger. It is a waiver of liability, which isn't going to be honored anyway, and it's certainly not something that I think we want to cause people to believe that they can't hold you responsible when, in fact, they can.
Let's hear from our other witness, and then we can have a discussion.
Madam Chair, if I may make up just a quick
Mr.
comment.
Mr. Baker?
Thank you. To your point, I'm not an attorney. Nor would I like to play one here. I would also like to just additionally point out that, you know, any business that is in the consumer eye, particularly the amusement industry, the waiver is also likely a requirement of the insurance carrier. And if you make any attempt to remove the waiver, if you make any attempt to say the waiver is simply null and void and we will not allow you or permit you to require a waiver, I can almost guarantee you that our insurance companies will then and say, well, then we can't insure the business, and it certainly is a requirement of our insurance carriers, which will close our businesses. There's no doubt.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
If the insurance companies are making that a requirement when they know very well that that's not the law, then what they would be trying to do is discourage people from making a valid claim simply by allowing them to think that they couldn't make a claim when, in fact, they can make a claim under the law. So I would question any insurance company making that a requirement of extending the insurance policy, insurance coverage, whether that's a valid, legitimate expectation. And I'd want to talk to that insurance company or ask our Department of Commerce to talk to that insurance company about that kind of a requirement.
Madam Chair, Senator, I respect that, and I certainly would basically, I guess I would close in saying that, you know, our insurance carriers looking at our company globally, I'm certain that there are specific laws to waivers in individual states, and, you know, the intent of the waiver is, as I stated earlier, to notify or to inform the consumer and to indemnify our owners from the negligent acts of others. That is the purpose of our waiver. And certainly if the committee feels or if your local judiciary feels that we have missed that mark, we can certainly review the waiver. But to remove the waiver in its entirety is simply it would close our business. It would literally mean the closing of five businesses in your state.
Let's go to our other witness, and then we can come back to have that conversation.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senators, may it please the committee. My name is Tom Whaley. I'm an executive vice president of and a part owner in the St. Paul Saints Baseball Club, a minor league baseball team that plays its games in St. Paul, Minnesota. And we're also an inflatables user, and we do own one of the devices that we use at our games. First off, I'd just like to say to the previous testifiers, on behalf of myself and the club, we're sorry to hear about the injuries to your children and not only your children but the others described in the testimony. And in no way would I want my comments to be construed as anything but supportive of the safe operation and regulation of these devices. We do have insurance for them. We do supervise them when we use them out at our park. So please don't let any comments – I'm not necessarily testifying against the legislation here. I happened to be home on a Saturday evening about 10 nights ago reading a publication about issues at the Capitol, and I don't know what that says about my social life, but I did come across this.
It's not baseball season.
I know, so that's what I do on Saturday evenings. I came across this issue with inflatables, and I know that we do use them. In our park, we have what we call a kids zone, where parents are able to take their kids or kids can go down and go into an area such as a swing set. We have a speed pitch machine where the kids can throw a batting tunnel sort of a deal, but we also do have an inflatable where kids go in and jump. And there's a slide of, I guess the height would be probably 8 to 10 feet tall. And so it caught my attention, and as I read through the proposed legislation, I thought to myself, I can't tell whether our use would be covered by something like that. And then I started to think, well, is it just us? And there may be other users that use these inflatables similarly to the way that we do. I'm not able to tell from this legislation whether it would apply to us or not. And I guess I would like some clarification. And what gives me pause, if this was just going to be legislation that that regulated inflatables as a whole, I would just say, well, that's a policy decision the state's making. But there are certain exceptions here. For instance, commercial use, not including an inflatable used at a carnival, festival, fair, private party, or similar venue. At a location other than a permanently located facility. I don't know what a permanently located facility is not defined here. We play our games in a public park, Midway Stadium, which is owned by the City of St. Paul. It's unquestionably a permanent facility. But is it a permanent facility in the nature that's described in this legislation? We play 48 games out at the ballpark where it's open and kids have access to it. Our primary purpose is not having children come in and using these inflatables or rides, but we do have them on our premises, and a lot of kids do use them. I guess as I started thinking about it, my brother runs a school-age daycare program, and he brings these devices in several times during the summer, and the kids use them. Does that apply to his use? I don't know that it's clear here. I'll use one more example. If the University of Minnesota were to have Goldie's Bounce House in conjunction with the football games out there, are they going to be subjected to it? So I guess what I'm trying to do is draw a line here and find out. I don't think it's a question that would simply be raised by us. I think there's wider applicability. So it seems to me that the legislation here is dealing with focusing on the place where these activities occur. And what we're trying to define is a use, a commercial use. So I don't know if that sheds any light on it, but I'm the reason I'm here, as I said, is not necessarily to testify against the legislation. It's just I would like some clarity, and I think it bears having some clarity because I don't think it's just going to be a user in our situation that's going to have a question of whether or not it applies to them. So I appreciate it.
Senator Sieben?
Madam Chair, just to respond to that, I draw the committee's attention to line 1.10, which says commercial use means regular use of an inflatable for profit. So it's my understanding and the understanding that House Counsel gave was that the Saints would not be covered by this because they're not using the inflatable for profit. So in other words, they're not marketing it. You don't come to the Saints game to jump or to get your children to jump on an inflatable device. You go to the Saints game for baseball But and it also on line 1.14, it says commercial use does not include use of an inflatable at a carnival, festival, fair, private party, or similar venue at a location other than the permanently located facility. So I do understand how there is some confusion because the Saints ballpark is a permanently located facility, but I would think that because of the commercial use definition in line 1.10, it wouldn't apply.
Mr. Whaley, though, when I take my kids to the Saints game and they want to go into the jumpity jump, you do have to pay an amount of money for the kids to go into the jumpity jump for the 3 or 5 minutes that they're in there, don't you?
Yes, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to thank you for bringing your kids to the Saints game. I got to get that on the record. But yes, you're correct. There is a nominal fee to go in and use the bounce house. And again, that's a question we had. Is that, you know, for profit? The primary reason that the kids are there is to watch a baseball game. It's not to go jump in the bounce house. And we don't market the bounce house as a reason to come to the Saints games. But there's no question we use that fee to sort of offset the supervisor, to be honest with you, that we have, you know, watching over the place. So it's again, I don't know that I cleared up the situation.
So Senator Sieben, even though they do charge a nominal fee for the kids to go bounce in the bouncy bounce, you would still maintain that they would not be covered.
Madam Chair, I didn't know that they charged a fee. So I think that perhaps the way I read it then is that they would be included. I would also point out that a letter that we received and said that one concern that the Saints have over it is the insurance requirements in subdivision 5, and they stated that the minimum medical payment coverage of $5,000 contained in the legislation is excessive and will be a hardship to small businesses such as the Saints. But I would also just put to the committee that obviously you know that if your child gets a broken arm while sustained in the jumpity jump, that your medical bill is very likely to cost more than $1,000 or could conceivably cost $5,000. So, I mean, I guess I don't know what to say about the instance for the baseball team except that perhaps they need to increase their insurance protection then.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Just
Mr. Whaley?
Yes, I'd just say we do have an insurance policy that would fall within the coverage limits that you describe here, so that wouldn't be an issue. It's just that our particular policy has a $1,000 medical expense limit, and my understanding now is that we can't get anything above that. I guess we could go back to our carrier. So I have a question. I mean, there's no question it's going to impact our ability to I don't know. Wouldn't go so far as to say to get insurance, but we certainly can't get it as I know it now, and I handle our insurance policies. I don't know that we can get a policy that would allow us to have that $5,000 limit in there. We could ask. I mean, I certainly would ask about that. But I guess where I come out, and I would like to go back a bit to the fact that we're for profit and would be covered. I would use the example of a county fair. A county fair is at a permanent facility in a lot of counties. They have a county fairgrounds, and if clearly you've exempted in the language a fair, which I understand, but how is that use necessarily any different from what we're doing? You've got a situation where there's a bounce house that folks come in. I could easily see where somebody would charge, you know, $2-3 to go in and jump in the house. And while you've specifically exempted a fair from coverage under this legislation, my question would be what's the logical rationale? How is the county fair different from how I'm using it? So again, I don't mean to be difficult. It's just by exempting these certain uses, you've created a scale along which people have to make judgments about whether they fall under it or not. And I'm just trying to find out where users like us would fall.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I keep looking at the phrase permanently located facility. And Senator Sieben, do you mean a building? I mean, I know nothing about these places. Are the House of Bounce and the whoever pump it up and all of them, are all of your rides in a building? Do you have any, like in the summertime, that you would have outside a building?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Baker?
I can only speak for Pump It Up. We are a destination-based business inside of a building. We do not rent in the outdoor rental industry, nor do we take our inflatables outdoor. There are those rare occasions when an owner may take an inflatable to, say, an expo or a children's expo show or those types of events, which are one-off events, to promote their business, but certainly not for profit. At that point, it's primarily and specifically done for marketing purposes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I guess I would ask counsel if, in the case of the Saints, as they explain, they take their actual jumper down when the games are not going, when it's not baseball season. So I don't know then if that's obviously maybe encompassed as a permanently located facility because the stadium itself is there. But I don't know if counsel has any suggestions or how you'd like to
Senator Sieben, I'm beginning to understand. I think when you talk about permanently located facility, I think you also mean that whose exclusive business is to provide children's recreation through these inflatables. I think, right?
Right. Well, Madam Chair, I'm kind of divided because I think that the Saints perhaps should up their insurance policy and be included too. But if the committee doesn't want to do that, then so be it.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, on line 1.11, we could change at a permanently located facility to in a permanently located facility or an indoor permanently located facility, something like that, and then the Saints would be kind of way out of it at that point, I dare say, but I don't know if that's what Senator Sieben wants to do.
Madam Chair, I would ask counsel if that sound, if you, in your opinion, if you think that would encompass them and not greatly expand, you know, carve out any other big exceptions that you can think of.
Members, so I'm hearing that there is a desire to try to address the Saints' concern. They have one bouncy bounce, so you know they.
Your kids like.
So they, there may be a desire to do that. I'm looking at the clock, and it's quarter after. We will not make it through the night if we don't take a little biological break here. I think what I would like, Senator Sieben, is for us maybe to spend the next 5 minutes talking through some of the areas where members might have concern. We're going to take a little dinner break, and I wonder if you could maybe work with the Saints or Mr. Baker or others to try to see if there's any other areas that you could address some of these concerns. It certainly was not my intention that this bill take this long. I figured by the time it gets to me on second engrossment, we would, Senator Shide, you would have taken care of everything in your committee. So I miscalculated on how long this would take. And
Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben?
If it's okay with the committee, I would agree to work with the Saints to cover their concerns. Perhaps what I suggested was that we,
maybe we could do that. This bill still has another stop in Economic Development Finance Committee. And so if we could, if I commit to the Saints to work with them on that particular issue before that next committee stop, perhaps we could pass the bill out and then deal
with
that. Even
when that happens, then the next committee will have to take another 2 hours or hour and a half to hear the same testimony. So I think since we as a committee have heard the testimony and we've spent the time on it already, let's do the work in this committee. And whatever we send to finance will be purely on the finance issue and not on the policy issues and the policy language.
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I wonder if we ought to include inflatable into the phrase permanently located facility, because I think that's what they mean. It's a place where these inflatables are. And frankly, the Saints could decide to have two. You know, they might do that. So I don't think it's because I think they are more like a carnival or a festival, a similar venue. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's what you are, and you're not in the business of offering inflatables.
Well, Madam Chair and Senators, I guess I'm just thinking this through. I'm just thinking this through, and that maybe the focus should be on the primary purpose of the business as much as anything. It seems to focus on a physical location, and if you've got a primary purpose is to, you know, invite children in to come in and play and take part in these devices, whether it's inflatables or some others, if that's your primary engagement, maybe that's the line. I don't know, but I mean, I know our business is not that, but I just have a concern again that we're defined
understand.
By this.
We understand.
Okay,
fine. We understand.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Members, so we have the three amendments before us. Senator Orman has already moved the A-10 amendment.
Which one is
that? Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid?
If I could speak to that, then I'd withdraw the A-8. I haven't actually officially offered it, but I think that we heard ASTM, and it's the A-10 amendment probably is a good enough reference.
All right, so let's are we ready? Members, do you feel that we should act on the A-10 amendment? Do we have sufficient input to do that? Senator Orman renews her motion on the adoption of the A-10 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Members, I have some reservations about the A-9 amendment. I think that that's an area that might need a little bit more work unless you all feel differently. I think that amendment alone could probably take us the rest of the night to talk about. I mean, I just feel like it's kind of a weighty issue for this committee. And we have to kind of keep moving. And so I am wondering if we recess for a break, if Senator Sieben and Senator Olson would take a look at this and in conversation with the industry. If, Senator Sieben, you are not at the point where you don't want to talk to them anymore, then we certainly can act on the amendment move forward, but I really cannot dedicate the rest of the night to this to this amendment. We've got to move some bills.
Madam Chair, I think that the committee should act on the A-9 amendment, and I'll give you one good reason why, is that what the industry said is that they're okay with liability waivers if it particularly is this narrowed, in that you could still have, as Senator Olson said, you could still have a release that says this activity that your child is about to engage in is dangerous. But all this is saying is that a parent can't waive the liability on behalf of a minor for injuries arising out of the commercial use of an inflatable. So, again, it's not getting rid of the entire permissions, the entire thing that you sign. It's just reinstating what is already that Senator Olson said, that these waiver of liabilities don't stand up in court anyway. So why put them in the waivers to begin with.
Madam Chair, if I may.
See, Senator Sebin, this is what I mean, that it's a little bit more than what's on the page. And Mr. Baker's going to speak, and then Senator Olson's going to speak, and I am telling you we're not going to get out of here if I don't give counsel and the rest of the members a break. So we're going to recess, and we will pick up with your bill, Senator Sebin, at 7:30, members. And you all can have a conversation about it, and if at the time when we pick it up, if all we need is to just act on this, then we'll just act on the bill. Okay, we are in recess. Especially.